Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Stella Blue Coffee is more than just great coffee. It's coffee with a purpose. Introducing We Brew to Rescue, a nationwide campaign using proceeds from our new ready-to-drink cans to help fund 1,000 pet adoptions this year. Every can you crack open helps a real pet find a real home. Simple as that. Made with 100% Colombian coffee, each 11-ounce can delivers smooth, drinkable energy with a boost of protein. Available in espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. Built for mornings, long days, and everything in between. Drink Stella Blue, fuel your day, and help save a pet's life. You can follow our progress in real time throughout the campaign by watching the adoption tracker on our site. Grab yours now at StellaBlueCoffee.com, Amazon, and select retailers nationwide.
Trust no one and accuse everyone. And Who's the Bad Guy? The official Barstool Sports social deduction game from the brilliant mind of Nick Tirrani. In what's quickly becoming the most popular new party game around, players are secretly assigned unique roles, with the good guys trying to expose the bad guys and the bad guys doing everything they can to stay hidden. Each game unfolds under alternating day and night phases, with roles like the cool chick, the shy guy, the gambler, El Presidente, the mentalist, the planner, the funny guy, and more. Every round is unpredictable, chaotic, and ridiculously fun. Who's the Bad Guy is great for parties, pre-games, family gatherings, or groups who just love deception-based games. Game night will never be the same. Shop now on Walmart.com.
All right, this episode of Project Big Screen, we have Pixar rankings, because we're doing Toy Story 5, also the death of Robin Hood, and is Shrek 5 the most hated trailer ever released? It's been out for about a week now. People loathe the Shrek 5 trailer, which they don't loathe Spider-Man, which we'll talk about as well. All that and more coming up on Project Big Screen. All right, Project Big Screen episode 38. 2 more weeks left in June. We're nearing a big, big, big July for movies. But a big week this week as well. A pretty big one. A huge release. Toy Story 5. We're talking Death of Robin Hood as well. New Hugh Jackman movie. Interesting one there. And then we're doing our top 10 Pixar movies. Obviously, pretty massive rankings here. Where do things fall? Where do things land? But let's start out. We had also a couple big trailers. One trailer is one of the most downvoted trailers on YouTube I've ever seen.
Wait, really?
Big hate. Like major. Really? Like turned off the comments. Hate.
The Marvel one.
No.
Oh. Oh, Shrek. The other one.
Yeah.
No, we talked about it
last week too, but yeah, I still need to get some things off my chest about that.
Oh, that's right. Cause you guys, I forgot we recorded midweek,
but it was honestly
the reaction of Shrek 5. Cause since then the reaction has been out and it's bad. It's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
People like are furious about the Shrek 5 trailer.
Yeah, you miss Clemmer said that Shrek's like the dumbest thing that ever came out in the animated world ever. Like he is a shocker, tremendous Shrek hater.
Huh. He started doing his cartoon thing where he just like once he wants to disrespect an animated movie, he just starts saying cartoon over and over again.
Yeah.
It's cartoons. Yeah. I don't watch cartoons.
Yeah, but meanwhile he'll literally suck E.T.'s like little brown cock. Then he'd rather been like no, has so many issues with the cartoon, but any kid's property that is live action is okay.
We did the Spielberg ranking too. And there was, I'm going to guess, just an error on your end putting the list together. You did not have E.T. on your list. Where would it have been?
Was it not on there?
No.
That might have just not. Yeah, I was doing it on a plane. So I think that might have been it. Obviously, the E.T. would have been like top three.
Yeah, I was going to say. Like,
I still think it landed pretty high, though. So.
Yeah, once Gooch said them, like there is actually no chance E.T. is not in Jeff's top five.
I can do an amendment on that list. Can tell you what it actually ended up being.
It was still was top five.
It was
in our ranking.
No, it was like eight.
Okay, yeah, it definitely.
I can tell you where it would have been.
I think it would have been at like five. If you had it like top three, I think it would have been five or four.
It would have bumped me down a spot.
E.T. is three for me on his list. Mm-hmm. So, I guess I can when we do our list, I'll do it. You know, we'll just do it now. Where would E.T. have landed had I had the proper vote?
So it would have bumped the BFG down from the three spot at least, and then I don't know where Tintin would have ended up. but
probably yeah. Behind the post at like 7.
Just behind the post.
I mean, if yeah. you follow me on Letterboxd, you know I did not put Disclosure Day in my top 15. And the more I think about Disclosure Day, last week was a mess, work travel wise and stuff. So things just kind of got all gummed up. I did want to talk about it, but the more I think about Disclosure Day, the more I dislike it.
That's kind of where
it just falls apart. It's here's my one comment on Disclosure Day, which I think is probably the worst thing you could ever say about a Steven Spielberg movie. The best way to watch that movie is to turn your brain off. But that's like what you say about a Michael Bay movie. Mm. And that's just like it's David Capp. The script is terrible. It's a terrible script. I still had fun with it. And there's some great stuff in it still too. Emily Blunt, the action stuff, all that is great. But it, not my favorite. New top 10, on the Spielberg, I'll mention it when we do our list later. Toy Story 5, when Bonnie receives a lily pad tablet as a gift and becomes obsessed, Buzz, Woody, and Jesse and the rest of the gang's jobs, we'll get to that part in a minute, become exponentially harder when they have to go head-to-head with the all-new threat to playtime. Screen time is the villain. Hour 42 minutes long, Andrew Stanton directing, he did Wall-E, he did Nemo, he did Finding Dory, he also did two live-action movies, which were fucking stinkers. John Carter, bad movie, but very recently In the Blink of an Eye, a sci-fi movie with Kate McKinnon. Dreadful movie. Like, so bad.
John Carter must die.
John Carter could have been better. John Carter also, part of John Carter's problem was the marketing was just a fucking disaster. Now, I'm not saying it's a good movie, but there is a little bit of that there. It definitely is hurt by its marketing and the fact that it bombed. Tom Hanks back, Tim Allen back, Joan Cusack back, not even back, like, a big time main player, Joan Cusack as Jesse. It's her movie. Greta Lee plays a lily pad, then the tablet. Conan O'Brien has a big character. Craig Robinson, Tony Hale, Bonnie Hunt, Kristen Shaw, Wallace Shawn, John Ratzenberger, Keanu Reeves, Ernie Hudson, Jeff Garland, Annie Potts. List goes on and on. $312 million worldwide. Biggest opening for the franchise. Not too shocked on that. 94-95% split on Tomatoes, IMDb 7.7, Metacritic 73, Letterboxd 3.8. Toy Story 5. What do you think, Ken Jack? Where do you have it?
I have it right now as an 88. I think I liked it a lot more than I liked Toy Story 4, but it's still not on the same, I would say, playing field as the first three. And I think that's something that we talk about a lot with Disney live action remakes, reboots, late sequels, anything like that. Is that, like, we know as adults, right, like, the primary goal is to make money. So from, I think, our perspective, what I really want is to just buy into the illusion that, like, make me believe for a second that you have something to say. Make me believe that for a second you're making this movie for some reason other than money, and that's it. I want, like, you know, like, the cipher in The Matrix, like, ignorance is bliss. Like, that's what I want. I want to buy into The Matrix. And I think this movie clears that bar because it has all the stuff that you expect out of Toy Story, which is, like, the visuals, good voice acting, solid kid jokes, and also some for adults, like a little bit of the infrared there. And it has something to say. And I think that the messaging here with screen time doesn't come off too badly to me as like just old man yelling at Sky, where it's like, things are different now. Stuff doesn't work the same way. And it feels like the message is more about kids trying to find their tribe and how they find it, whether that be through screen time or that be through something else. And I like that messaging a lot. So, like, is it better than the first three? No. But I appreciate that it clearly had a lot more to say than Toy Story 4, which is a big step in my opinion. So I'm at an 88.
Okay. I actually liked it a little less than Toy Story 4. I gave Toy Story 4 a 90. I rewatched it. I quite like Toy Story 4, and I like this too. I give it an 89 to just a hair below it. I think it's very enjoyable. My biggest issue with it, and this is not a spoiler or anything, I'm just going to give you the warning to people. The side characters, I just think, have taken too much of a backseat in this franchise. Now, I do wonder how much of that is voice actors passing away. Mm. The voice actors, I mean, from Don Rickles to Jim Varney, obviously they're not alive anymore. So Mr. Potato Head, Slinky, like, and they were all there through Toy Story 3. Jim Varney was not alive for Toy Story 3. They did replace him. But obviously since then we've lost, who else was lost in the voice cast? Oh, it's going to drive me nuts. Anyway, point being, I don't know if that's part of it. Oh, Estelle Harris passed away, obviously. Both Potato Heads. So I don't know if that's part of it. But for me, it's like if you go back and you watch one and you watch two and you watch three, especially like two, like two's got the great stuff at Al's Toy Barn. The side characters are such a big part of it. And I just think they take such a massive back seat in these movies. And it kind of takes away from it a little bit for me. But I like the story here. I like the villain here. I like how they do it. I think one, two, and three are just a cut above the rest by a pretty heavy margin. But I did enjoy this. It's enjoyable. But I just wish maybe a little better. And I do think that's part of it. I think the side stuff. I mean, Wallace Shawn's alive. John Ratzenberger's alive. Like, they're still voicing the characters. Like, those characters are, they just feel less of, like, I mean, I grew up, I'm a Toy Story kid. I was four when the first one came out. Like, I don't know. It's like the gang was my thing, right? Like, I liked Buzz and Woody, but like, it was the whole gang. Like, that's who I liked. So that's kind of my big takeaway from the adult perspective. In terms of like what they're trying to do, I think they did a great job. So that's where I have it, 89.
Yeah. That would explain, because I think my biggest complaint coming out of the theater was, this is all very competently made, like excessively competently made. Like, I would go ahead and place your bets on this winning best animated feature. Like, it really is just doesn't have a blemish anywhere. But it's not that funny. And I think that is where the good jokes were almost not exclusively coming from those side characters, but they played such a large role in like getting me to laugh. Like, we talked last week about, I was doing a rewatch of the first two, like the Rip Torn stuff with the Little Green Army Men. So fucking funny. Like, hilarious. Learned, right? Like,
everyone has passed away.
Yeah. Everything on the side. Army, yeah.
Yeah. They died.
Provided such a jolt of comedy every time they were on screen. And you're right. They were pushed to the side here. Although another side character in Jesse, who I guess maybe not side, but she got her time to shine here. But I thought this was extremely well done. Pixar flexed their just top of the line animation department at several points in ways that I don't think they've gotten to in the past few years, even since like, what was the last one? Not Hoppers, but before that.
Free Hoppers, ago. Like Elio or like?
Like Elemental, they got to do some stuff there. But this, like the Buzz, and we'll talk more spoilers, but like the Buzz is, the Buzz Army side plot gave them a shot to really flex. And then the imagination sequences were fucking incredible.
I love that.
They're great. The Buzz in the water, obviously that's an homage. It looked amazing with the neon low, with the light, with the glow in the dark parts. It was that looked great. I mean, the Toy Story does look amazing.
Yeah, you can tell they have just their A team on this. Like, you really can. And I was worried to Kinjek's point. I was worried going in because there is just so much low hanging fruit available for the tech bad storyline.
Yep.
And I thought they did a very good job of being nuanced on it without completely, you know, giving themselves over to, they could have easily gone extreme in one way or the other. They could have just been like, hey, kids should not be on these things. Kids should not be playing with iPads or lily pads or what have you. They didn't do that. And they also didn't say like, no, these are actually good. This is just like what kids play with these days. And the old toys are gone. And this is just part of life. No, they said like, it has its place, but you know, old toys do too. I really respected that. So I'm landing at an 85. I was pleasantly, I wouldn't say surprised by this, but there were some fears going in that this could be a letdown because it's the fifth movie in a franchise. And anytime you get this deep, you got to have those concerns. But I thought they did a really good job. Really, really good job. Now, I would like to hear how kids are responding to it, because it plays to kids, but like you said, Kinjek, it does have more adult stuff in it, which has kind of been a Pixar trademark for about 10 years now. But I would like to hear, like, are kids loving this? Because I haven't really heard about that yet.
Hmm. Seems like it. I mean, it's getting very high audience marks.
Yeah.
So
kids in my audience loved it. I'm sure I watched it the same way you did, where it's just in a giant loaded theater full of little kids. And then just yourself as a 30, whatever year old in the back of the theater, just like, I am not a pedophile. Like, I almost want to like wear a shirt like it says it. But all the kids in the theater were having a raucous time. So, I mean, I think in that regard, almost hard to say it's not a success.
Yeah, I did the Sunday night showing in New York City.
Smart.
Which means that it was just a bunch of people getting high outside the theater and walking in. There were no kids in my audience. Let me put it that way.
Mm. Yeah. I think we'll get into spoilers here because I mean, how long are we going to spend on this? It is Toy Story. But my like you kind of know what you're getting here, and I think they're going to make another one. I would assume. It just doesn't hit as profound for me as the other four. Honestly, I think it's by a hair compared to four. But then obviously with one through three, it's like it just doesn't. Mm-hmm. Hit that mark that kind of leaves a lasting impact, which those three do, especially three, which is just otherworldly in terms of like storytelling for a fucking animated movie. It is unbelievable. Not for best picture. So yeah, I mean, I like where they go with it. I like how they kind of wrap up Jesse's storyline, but kind of dive deeper into it. And there are some nice moments, like there's some nice revelations. And we're into spoiler territory now, but her, you know, kind of digging up her old stuff,
yeah,
and see, you know, going back to the old house, seeing that she did leave an impact on her owner, all that stuff is really nice. But I think, you know, and even the ending is nice with like, you know, making friends and like, you know, the tablet. And the tablet's not, by the way, a full villain. Not a full line.
No, it's good.
This tablet ain't Stinky Pete or Lotso like that. Yeah. You can't do that when you're Disney. And you got that Disney Plus app on kids' tablets. You got to mm-hmm. make the tablet somewhat of a redeemable character, right?
Very redeemable. I mean, this might make me a bad person, but when the tablet realizes, when Lilypad realizes that she's caused harm to poor Bonnie, and she throws herself, she kills herself.
Yeah,
she's like she kills herself. She jumps off the table and throws herself in the donation bin. That kind of made me laugh. I was like, whoa.
That's the thing of strength to it too, though. It's like it's even with the pad wants what is best for Bonnie, right? Yes. And like even then with the parents, I think that's like this, you get the whatever their view on it, because like if you're a parent and like you want to get your kid something that helps them relate to other kids more because you want your kid to have friends, that's the pad. Even if you don't want them to have it, you would rather them be playing with like regular toys or being like more of a kid like you were growing up. You want to get them whatever it is that helps them relate to other children more. And like that isn't necessarily what might not be best for them, but it's what helps them socially. So I don't know. It's weird. It's cool. Like, I think way that they approached it.
Yeah. I think they did a very nice job. But like they've also, I mean, there is a point where it's like you have run out of things too. Mm. Like you can't make too many more of these. Because I guess they've now hit the next trend, right? They've hit technology. They split them up in the last one. You know, the owner gets older in the one before that. The one before that, you know, it's kind of about like identity and importance and like, you know, like the lost toy thing and, you know, grappling with being the toy that's whatever, not love. And that's kind of what the first one is as well, just in a different way. But it's like, how many more of these, like what's the next step on Toy Story 6? I don't know.
Yeah.
They do the Rose toy. They go into Bonnie's mom's drawer, find those toys.
Yeah.
No. They already have Buzz. He's there.
Maybe they go to the museum now. I don't know. So I don't know. I don't know.
They're also called Buzz and Woody. The toys in the mom's drawer.
Yeah. I liked it though. I enjoyed it. One of the better Pixar in the last couple of years, obviously, and they do a very nice job with Toy Story, and they obviously put in maximum everything to make sure that these don't stink. And they've released five and none of them are even come close to stinking. Mm-hmm. So that does say something. Because yeah. Pixar does have an issue with some sequels for sure. That's for sure. But we all did like Toy Story 5. So check out Toy Story 5. Worth a watch. I would assume for most people ends up near the bottom of their lists in terms of Toy Story movies, but probably middle of the road at worst with Pixar. And we will have our full top 10 Pixar movies coming up in a little bit. Another movie we're going to talk about, The Death of Robin Hood. Interesting one here. Grizzled take on Robin Hood. Grappling with his past after a life of crime and murder, Robin Hood finds himself gravely injured after a battle he thought would be his last. In the hands of a mysterious woman, he's offered a chance at salvation. He's greatly troubled by and weary of his long history of murder and crime. A very dark Robin Hood movie, comes from A24, Hugh Jackman, Jodie Comer's in it, Bill Skarsgård is Little John, Murray Bartlett's in it. not a strong weekend at the box office, kind of as I'd expect us to really bring in billions of dollars, 2.7 million domestic opening, 70%, 61% split on tomatoes. Not so totally shocked by that. 6.5 IMDb, 60 Metacritic, Letterboxd 3.1. Michael Cernovsky did this movie. Also did Big. Excellent movie. A Quiet Place Day One as well. Gooch, where do you have The Death of Robin Hood?
I'm landing at a 70 on this one. There will be an audience for this who will really eat it up just because we do not get, I think, enough movies set in this time period, the medieval stuff that's really well made. I think like Eggers is like the only one really trying to do it at a high level like this. And Cernovsky kind of knocked it out of the park. I really have become enamored with his style. We joked about it in our interview, but like the misty, like very dewy nature, it's very atmospheric. And that's been like his trademark through these three movies. And that kind of like anti-revenge storyline, which he brings across here too as well. I thought it was another great Jackman performance. It's not his best. I think if you want to compare it to Logan, which it's not a complete one-to-one, but there are similarities there. I do think the Logan performance is just better.
Yeah, he's really profound. Good. And there's a little bit of history to the Logan thing too, which is unfair to this, but like there's a build-up to that, which
exactly.
Again, it's unfair to compare, but like that exists in that movie and you kind of have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, but I did think this is really, really well done. I think the story is very interesting in terms of kind of deconstructing the myths that we love and like kind of how stories change over time and the things we idolize and how we change history in real time just to kind of fit what we want. Really impressed by that. And I was really, really impressed by the first 30 to 45 minutes of this where there's quite a bit of action. It does have a problem in the back two acts of this movie where it comes to a screeching halt, and I think it is just a little too slow, a little too dour, and I think we'll have a tough time, and the box office is reflecting that, we'll have a tough time really grabbing an audience and creating really any kind of excitement about the movie. So I'm landing at a 70. I'm excited for what Cernovsky does best. Yeah, it's niche. I'm excited for what Cernovsky does next. I think he has a much better movie in him than this. But this is good. This is a good movie.
Ken Jack, I know you quite liked it, right?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I landed on 87 for it. And I think that like just visually that he really gets it, Cernovsky. I mean, and like in our interview, we talked about him with the two. They shot this in like a month in Ireland on film. Real locations, real fields, real mud. Real glens with mist and shit flowing through. And I think you could feel that. And that's so often missing from movies, especially ones that like get like a good cast and like high A-list actors or whatever. So stunning visually. I think story-wise, you mentioned a lot of it, Gooch, like his approach to the legend of Robin Hood and like how he dissects stuff like that and like how it changes and like even whatever history written by the Victor, all that sort of thing, and how different people's sort of appropriated the legend of Robin Hood and what he might have actually been. But I liked it a lot. And I agree with you. The first half of it is very action heavy, much more similar to like the opening of something like The Northman, which I think it reminded me of in bits and pieces. And then the second half is something more like Valhalla Rising, which I also really like, which is more like meditative and more like surreal at points and more like what's really like sit in with this guy and like what he's feeling and all that. And that I will totally understand is not everyone's cup of tea, and I would never fault anybody for watching this and be like, I was really bored, I didn't like it, snooze fest, blah 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 blah. But like for me, I'm really like engrossed in that, and I really enjoy that. So I like that. I think Jackman was awesome, and like you guys are saying with the Logan comps, like definitely there's something there, but I also think his job in this movie is significantly harder than his job in Logan was, because in Logan, like you're always rooting for Logan. You're 100% in Logan's time for 100% of the movie. You want Logan to succeed. In the introduction of this movie, you are told right away, Robin Hood sucks. This guy is an asshole. He's a murderer. He's a thief. He's a piece of shit. You hate his fucking guts. And yet you still, throughout the course of the movie, flip to his side and wanting him to have that sort of resolution, which I think is a way harder job, at least performance-wise, for an actor. And Jodie Comer was awesome. Great. Obviously, she's every period piece she's been in has been, at least in my opinion, a home run from her from a performance standpoint. And also, like, Bill Skarsgård was unrecognizable to me. I did not realize that was Bill Skarsgård at all. I didn't know he was playing Little John, but like I remember we saw it at the same screening, and like we left and we're like, where was Bill Skarsgård? It's like, oh, that was him. Like, didn't recognize him. Obviously, you're not supposed to recognize Murray Bartlett, but he was also transformative too. And I think both of them gave really good performances, and like limited screen time, especially Bartlett, who I think gives like a pretty impressive, I would say, like monologue with him as he's like there in that church or whatever. So yeah, really impressed by them. I think Sarnowski, this is like proof positive to me that he can hit in different genres too. And I was also impressed when we talked to him. I think pretty smart guy. So yeah, very excited to see whatever. I would agree with you, Gooch. Very excited to see what he has next.
Yeah, I'm kind of with where around where Gooch is. I got a 71. I enjoyed a good amount of this. I liked how it kicked off. The beginning is great. I just kind of there's a bit of a lack of keeping that energy throughout for me that I wish it kind of would have kept, and it didn't exactly land. Because I know what you're saying, Ken Jack. I think that's pretty evident with this. Is that like, you are supposed to fucking not like him, right? Like you are supposed to view him as this villain. So it's not like this grizzled like Logan, but there it just doesn't the rest of the way. Like I don't know, it just doesn't fully land or do anything profound for me or say anything. I like it. I like it, but I don't know. Like it almost. Am I crazy for saying like it should have just kept that beginning of the movie energy throughout the whole thing? And I think what they were trying to achieve would have landed more, because like I thought in the beginning, I'm like, oh, this guy's just gonna be and this is gonna be endless violence, piece of shit from start to finish, and I'm gonna have to like take a knee when the movie's over.
Mm. I get the thought process, but also then like how do you land with him getting any redemption if like it's just full violence all the way through? Like that works in Logan, right? Where that's where basically what it is. You're full throttle violence throughout most of the movie, but you're on his side. Like he's rough around the edges, but you're on Logan's side for every second of that movie. But you need I think a slowdown to a degree, at least to like build some empathy with the character of Robin Hood. At least that's what I felt while I was watching it.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. It's a huge, huge swing. This movie is a massive swing, and it's one of those ones that shout out A24 for trying something with this, and it looks fantastic. But I don't know. It's almost like I think you almost had to. The way it sets it up, the way it postures from the beginning, like it almost just had to stay like he is just the worst the whole way. I don't know if that's maybe that doesn't work. Maybe I'm nuts on that. I don't know. Because I still liked it.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think it'd be hard because then who's your antagonist? If he's just a bad way the whole way through, I guess who's your antagonist, protagonist, right? I already know. Are you on like
would that
Noah
have been
Jupe
interesting if you go like full on like he is like you take the myth and you just flip it on its fucking head and he's just like this just absolute piece of shit and there's another he's the antagonist the whole way through. Is that too much of a swing?
See, I also like, and I guess this is kind of like a spoiler talk, but I also like the flip with Jodie Comer's character, like when they do the reveal for her backstory and everything like that. Like I thought that part was very like, oh shit. And like, so you don't get something like that out of that movie, I guess. So I don't know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. I guess that'd be my one, I guess, swing that just doesn't. It's like, man, like I'd be curious how that would have played, because I could very well be sitting here talking about if they did that. Where like, you know, the movie ends with like the townspeople fucking slashing Robin Hood's throat because he's such a bad guy, right? Like I guess you could do that, but then I could be sitting here saying, well, that was fucking stupid. Like that was like that almost sounds like some like Zack Snyder like edgelord bullshit. Right, we're like maybe that's too stupid, because I don't know, maybe that's dumb, because that's my big like that's the big thing that didn't work for me. I'd say
I will say this is the best Robin Hood movie in 25 years. When was the Costner one?
That was 90s, right? So early 90s, like 30 years, really.
30 years, which is nuts for like a character that has been on movie screens for. I mean, since the dawn of movies.
Yeah.
We've kind of hit a lull, right, of not a lot of Robin Hood stuff.
We had the Edgerton one.
Yeah, that Taron one killed it.
Yeah.
I think people were like,
yeah, you have
nope.
The 2018 Taron Egerton one with Jamie Foxx, which
the
is...
The Ridley Scott one.
Yeah, it's a bad... And what's-her-face is in it? Fucking... Butu's daughter. Bono's daughter. Who was in Soldier Day.
Yeah,
Eve Houston. Yeah, she's in it. Who?
What a character, right?
Not great in Disclosure Day.
Did she? She stunk. Day. It's very hard to blame her because the writing is not exactly helpful for her, but she was not good.
Yeah, I mean, the 2010 Ridley Scott one is
also
not great.
Yeah.
Horrible. Terrible movie. And then, yeah, I guess you go back to Prince of Thieves, right?
Yeah. Prince of Thieves, or honestly, you could do Men in Tights if you want to technically consider that.
And yeah, if you really want to rip something, maybe Men in Tights is fantastic.
Yeah. Or the animated one, too, also not bad.
I'm high on Men in Tights. I know some people don't love Men in Tights, but I'm high on it. I think it's an excellent movie. But I love Mel Brooks stuff. Yeah, there really have been a ton. Was he in Snow White?
Who?
The live action Snow White. Wasn't that basically Robin Hood? Didn't they basically put him in the movie?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the new
I boycotted like, it.
The love interest character, I'm pretty sure is it's basically Robin Hood. Okay. That's the thing though. It's like what is the cultural interest in Robin Hood in 2026?
I think it works because he's like so class warfare based, and like that is kind of the topic du jour right now.
Yeah,
I think if you took it, obviously this is like going in the complete opposite. Like it's trying to run away from the classic telling of Robin Hood, but I do think like a classic telling of Robin Hood, if done right, would really work right now.
Yeah,
really, really work.
Yeah, it's gonna be like very pared down, I guess, like very simplified. But I like this one a lot.
Yeah, this is a cool swing. I didn't love it. I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. Like I didn't walk out being like, yeah. And I actually kind of liked it more the more I thought about it. But I think Swarovski's a really good director, and the look of this is also fantastic. It does look great too.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful movie.
So you know, I hope. Look again, like you know, Pig is something else. Like Pig's an excellent movie that kind of got lost in the year it came out and should have been nominated for more things. It should have gotten more recognition. And I know the people that have seen Pig quite like it. He also did the A Quiet Place movie, which is obviously a big time one for you, one for me type thing.
I think he literally said that.
Did he really say that?
I think he like
and that movie's really solid too. Like I think I fucking like that movie more than this one. But this is like a swing and it's his thing and he went for it and that's cool and I'm excited to see what he does next.
Yeah,
essentially.
No, he was very impressive when we talked to him. Like I would place a future on him right now if I could. Like he's got the juice as a writer and a director. For sure.
Yeah, like even though like story didn't fully work for me here, like I respect it and I see what he's going for and I like that much. So mm-hmm. Yep. Check out Death of Robin Hood from A24 in theaters. Now definitely check it out. Need some you know, go see the Toy Story, go see the Blockbusters, but this is smaller movie, which deserves some more love. Because yeah, that's a director that should definitely be making more things. Next week, Supergirl, which I know you guys talked to Craig Gillespie. Mm-hmm. But Supergirl comes out next week. You also have the apparently the last Jackass movie.
It should be.
So they say. And then an invite as well from Olivia Wilde. So a big week. A big week next week in the theaters. Potentially. We'll talk about Supergirl in a minute. I'm not sure how big of a week it'll be. The reactions are pretty positive. People seem to like it. People seem to have a good time with it, but we'll get to that in a minute. But we'll see how the box office does this last week before a pretty massive July, which has Minions and Monsters.
Let's go.
Moana, which we'll see. I could see Moana maybe underperforming.
Every time I see that trailer.
The vibe I'm getting from like parents I talk to is that they are not that interested in
super off-putting.
Yeah.
We have the Odyssey, obviously. That's going to be humongous. I know you're pumped, Gooch, for The Dink, the pickleball movie. We're going to trailer for that in the next 48 hours.
Wait, there's a different one? There's one Chris Farley that just came out recently, too. That's crazy.
Another pickleball movie?
Yeah.
With Chris Farley?
Not Chris Farley. Pete Farley, his brother.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, if it's Chris Farley, that will make $1 billion.
I came back just to do a pickleball movie.
Spider-Man, all that, which we'll talk about Spider-Man here in a second.
Hey, LCB listeners, we're going to take a quick break for a message from one of our partners.
Mein Name ist Alexandra und ich habe GoFundMe genutzt, indem ich einen Spendenaufruf darüber gemacht habe für eine Familie. Ich wohne in der Innenstadt von Leipzig und es hat bei uns einen ganz, ganz schlimmen Brand gegeben, Wohnungsbrand, der sich über mehrere Etagen tatsächlich ausbreitete. Wir sind so ein Mehrfamilienblock und mein Freund war derjenige, der gesagt hat, ey, guck mal, hier gibt es ein Portal. GoFundMe heißt das, dann mir angeschaut und das war dann der Startpunkt. Also was ich jetzt natürlich erreichen konnte, die Familie hat jetzt erstmal eine Notunterkunft. Die haben vorher wirklich auch in einem Hotel-Hostel gelebt, sind jetzt seit der letzten Woche in einer ja vorübergehenden Wohnung, haben jetzt aber die Chance gehabt, wirklich Kinderzimmer zu kaufen.
Starte deinen Spendenaufruf noch heute. In nur wenigen Minuten auf GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com für deinen Spendenaufruf. Dies ist eine bezahlte Anzeige von GoFundMe.
All right, now back to the episode.
You guys recorded. I don't want to talk too much on things you guys talked about.
I think it literally dropped while we... I think we were recording and it came
out. I think it's good. So I have a... I guess it's a compliment sandwich here. Really good trailer. The middle of the sandwich is the negative here for me. Way too much shown in this trailer. Like, preposterous amounts. That's the Sony calling card.
Yeah, I stopped watching it.
It's just like, I don't know why I watched the whole thing. But then I'll end the compliment sandwich on the other half. Really good trailer. Like, got me very excited. Looks really cool. I'm curious where the story goes. Obviously, there's a huge question which can swing this movie. First of all, we saw Hulk transform for the first time in like 15 years. I'm excited to see like Savage Hulk. This movie and its success, and I'm talking about this from the nerd side of things, because the movie's gonna make a shitload of money, but how this movie is viewed and how it's talked about in the nerd community is gonna be massively tied to whoever the fuck Sadie Sink is playing. And I'm still not fully convinced she's Jean Grey, but if there was a meter of Jean Grey, not Jean Grey, the meter is definitely swinging heavy Jean Grey right now. I don't mind them introducing her in this movie. I think that's a cool swing to make. They've obviously introduced big characters in smaller roles. Spider-Man was introduced in Civil War. So was Black Panther. But Jean Grey is a pretty big character. And obviously there's some sort of mutant mutation storyline here with Peter Parker. So it would make sense. Really good trailer, but showed way too much. Like a shocking amount of stuff shown.
Yeah. Also I got about like a fourth of the way through and I tapped out and I was like, I don't want to watch this anymore. I don't want to learn or anything. I want to figure stuff out in the theater, you know?
Yeah. I've been like that with, most trailers, especially the Odyssey right now, because they've really ramped up the TV ads, and the TV ads always just show way too much stuff. Way, way, way too much stuff. But I did think this trailer, they very clearly like tweaked how it looked from the first trailer. Like they, in a good way, like they, the contrast, you can tell they cranked the contrast up, turned the exposure down a little bit. It looks way more cinematic, which I appreciate greatly. I do worry there's maybe a little, is there any concern that this movie's a little too stuffed? There's a lot of characters in this, which I think the Spider-Man movies have done a decent job at points of.
Not the last one,
but the first two, I think, did a pretty good job of being contained to Peter Parker's life. And I do worry that maybe, there's a lot of people in here. It'll be fun to see him going up against the Hulk and stuff like that. But anytime these superhero movies start getting a little too bloated, you can run into some problems. But I'm pumped for it. Very pumped. And they're teasing like Peter Parker might fucking die in this movie, which I guess they always have to do. But Zendaya's out here like, bring the tissue box because we're going there. I'm like, okay. All right, Tom Holland.
He just fucking dies. But I guess they bring him back and fucking.
Jean Grey brings him back. I also think Spider-Man, that's smart. Because Spider-Man he has in the comics before. He's a good crossover for the X-Men because he's, young, can relate to the students at St. Xavier's or whatever they call that, Xavier's School for
Gifted Misfit Toys. Youngsters.
So, that does make sense. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it. I'm excited. If this does well, it's going to very much fuel whatever happens with Avengers in December for Marvel. This would be a big win for them. This ends up being good. Careful on Avengers Doomsday stuff, by the way. There's a lot of leaks starting to happen. And they're not finished either, which is like, I'm not saying leaks are good, but it's even worse when it's like not finished VFX. It just creates. So we'll see how this plays into that. But no, I'm very excited for the thing. This looks really cool. And I'll tell you, if this ends up being really good, and like I like Shang-Chi quite a bit, Destin Daniel Cred, I mean, this would be two Marvel movies where
hits
like kind of, which is like, that's kind of crazy. Two completely different franchises. And I know the Russos did Captain America as well as Avengers, but that's a little different. These are like two character stories. So we'll see.
Didn't he do Wonder Man too?
I think he was like a producer or something.
Right? Yeah. He was heavily involved in Wonder Man.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fantastic.
Directed two episodes, also the co-creator. So yeah, that's actually, fuck that. That's three things. Yeah. That's pretty crazy. So you guys talk Shrek 5, but since then, Shrek 5, oh boy, stunning reaction to Shrek 5 on online. People hate it. People hate it.
Good. Looks horrible. I don't know what they were thinking.
It was one of the worst trailers for a franchise I've ever seen. And I'm not saying it like, look, the animation thing is the animation thing. You've advanced in animation. It's hard to, what are you going to, are you going to animate it exactly like the OG?
No.
Right? Now, Toy Story does a very good job. I mean, Toy Story and Toy Story 2 is huge compared to Toy Story to now. But they still, there's not like this unrecognizability to Toy Story, right? Like it just looks like it's, you know, it's kind of slowly worked its way up. This looks crazy. So the comments are turned off completely, which is crazy. It got 2.6 million views on YouTube, which is not very good. And this is not like they're resurrecting. This is not like they're resurrecting like Ichabod Crane. Like it's Shrek. No offense to Ichabod Crane. But
it's
like
goofball shit, yeah.
Spider-Man, 25 million views. And I know Marvel's bigger, but Shrek is pretty fucking relevant still. And pretty big. Yeah. So yeah. I want to find what the dislikes are in the video. Because it's pretty fucking crazy. I don't know how to find it. They kind of hide that.
Disabled
now.
It, yeah.
I said
anyway,
last
I'll find the second. But yeah, the trailer, it just, there was something about the trailer. It was just terrible. Like, it was almost like they, like, is there any, like, what's the story? What's the movie? What's the anything?
They got Marcelo Hernandez ogre with the broccoli haircut. What are we doing?
Yeah, again, and, you can't talk shit on that.
And as I wear my, this is not a squad, it's a family.
The family.
Avatar shirt. But the jokes weren't funny either. Like, they were really, I thought, like, beneath them, which for a Shrek franchise, like, that's absurd to say, but, like, Shrek is funny. Like, mm-hmm. having the gingerbread man have, like, big-ass cheeks and being like, I'm caked up now. Mm-hmm. Not funny. And I said they should, like, go back to the lab and maybe Sonic this thing. Apparently, they already did that. I forgot that.
They did. Because the reaction to the first one was so bad.
And this is what they came back with? Like, I mean, this could be disastrous for them if they don't.
67,000 likes, 102,000 dislikes.
Jesus. It's like a Will Smith movie video or whatever.
Yeah, they already went. Do you remember from the first, was it not T, was it Pictures? Is that what it was?
I think it was Pictures because they were like, Zendaya is now, I don't know.
Yeah.
What is Zendaya's Michi now? I don't know. Like, she's the daughter, and people like looked at the picture and they were like, what the fuck?
Yeah,
it's like, sure. I just like.
Also, do they need to have three children? Do we need three ogre babies?
Mm. Now we have
probably two characters. Probably right on that. Yeah, this was bad. This was disappointing, honestly. So those are the two big trailers. Mentioned Supergirl reactions, decent. People seem like they're having fun with it, but box office could be an issue. We'll see how that goes. Ticket sales are interesting, to say the least, when I was looking at it. But I will be seated, very excited to go see it. Mm-hmm. From Craig Gillespie. Live-action Grinch, apparently, in the works.
Grinch 2.
Sequel. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Live-action Grinch sequel. Jim Carrey expected to return. Ron Howard expected to return in some capacity.
It was an interesting crew that they had writing it. It was like a bunch of like Curb Your Enthusiasm alum. The guys that like basically wrote Cat in the Hat, which I don't think was right for kids, but was good for adults. So it's a strange crew adding on to Ron Howard. But I'm interested. But I'm a big live action Jim Carrey Grinch defender. So
yeah, I'm not against it at all. I think Jim Carrey very much, although he is like retired, basically, he still got it. When he appears in those Sonic movies, like he has his fastball very much. Mm-hmm. But the question I think will be like, I think a big part of why I love that first Grinch is like the production value on it, which is notably like almost killed him. Doing that makeup and wearing that suit, like, are they going to be able to do that again with a 60-year-old Jim Carrey? I don't know, how old is he now? Probably late 50s, 60s.
I think 60s. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, recapturing that kind of production level, you just don't see that really in movies anymore. Like that specific type of like very like stagey kind of costuming.
He's gonna end up looking like what's her name in X-Men Apocalypse, where like she just like clearly didn't want to be in the chair, so they just like made her makeup
Jennifer
like
Lawrence.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence, where like the makeup like was half-assed. She's like, just get me out of here.
Yeah, this we'll see. What's the story on this? What's there to say? He's fine now. He's got the big heart.
He's supposed to be a good guy. So maybe there's a new Grinch. I don't know. Good question.
Doing Hanukkah.
Doing Hanukkah now? In Whoville?
He's going to other holidays. Timothée Chalamet and Selena Gomez are in a new animated movie. I thought he was taking a break for a while. It is an animated movie. But it's called Not Alone from Illumination. Yeah. It's an animated alien movie. Maybe this is a break then. He's taking a break. He's lending out his voice. An introverted rocket mechanic who lives a quiet life alone.
Is this for adults?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound from Illumination, I'd assume no.
Yeah.
I thought I saw it described as a rom-com, though. Huh. Which I guess a lot of animated movies are kind of.
In his first ever feature-length animated film, four-time Oscar nominee Chalamet will star as Joe, introverted rocket mechanic, co-starring with Chalamet's Emmy and Grammy nominee Gomez as Fran, a brilliant astrobotanist who is developing the world's first ever plant-fueled rocket. When Joe and Fran are brought together to prepare for the inaugural launch of the revolutionary rocket, there are immediate sparks, but neither is particularly adept at romance. Life becomes more complicated when three aliens, tiny, unruly, and adorable, take refuge in Joe's home. Are they minions? Dunk, Welly, and Shrim are on the interplanetary run from a zealous yet inept officer of the law named Zandro. The aliens determine that Fran's rocket could provide their means of getting back home safely.
This is more like a teen thing, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm into that. I'm interested to see, I'd say, Chalamet take on a new medium. Maybe he's a great voice actor. I like his voice. I think he's a really good voice.
I think he did.
Yeah.
I think he did that Kid Cudi series or movie.
Oh, really?
Intergalactic. I think he
forgot about that, yeah.
Did a bit role in there. But yeah, no, this could be good. Who knows? I do think Illumination is probably better than we give it credit for. Although they do have a habit of doing some really lowbrow stuff. I think their animation department has beefed up quite a bit in the past few years. And
I'm sure once they get Chalamet signed on, it's like, okay, we're locked in. I'm sure the budget got good on this one.
Yeah. And it's Selena Gomez's follow-up to Emilia Perez. So gotta be excited
right,
for that.
Right.
How can we possibly forget?
Can't forget that.
God.
Oscar
nominated.
Netflix and A24 have now passed on Luca Guadagnino's movie Artificial. It's an AI-based movie. It's based on like the world of AI, I believe, correct?
Yeah, it's biography on Altman.
Social network for Altman.
Yes. And then it was dropped initially by Amazon after OpenAI's partnership, conflict of interest. Netflix said no, A24 said no, Focus said no.
I saw Neon maybe? Circling. Maybe, yeah.
That's right. Andrew Garfield with Sam Altman, Monica Barber in it as well. Yura Borisov from Anora is in it. Ike Barinholtz, Cooper Hoffman, Jason Schwartzman, Billy Lord, Chris O'Dowd, Mark Rylance. So yeah, it does not have a home right now.
Yeah, this is crazy. This is honestly, I think, like the story of the week.
I get the Amazon thing. Now, I'm not saying it's like good for them, great move. I'm just saying like, okay, whatever. You partner with the guy, you know, like whatever. Like, sure, fine, whatever. Makes sense. But I figured like anybody else would have picked this up.
Yeah, it's a little concerning.
That's where I was like shocked. It's like what I like again, I get the conflict of interest. Like if they don't want to do it, if they'd rather be dead with opening eye, well, okay, whatever. Fucking Amazon. It's not like we're talking about some mom and pop shop that just got in, you know, it's whatever, it's Amazon. But again, no one, I'm kind of shocked A24 said no. Maybe like Neon will pick this up. Neon seems to pick up everything they can.
Yeah, I was reading that it basically like kind of boils down to whoever is not keeping, like not interested in incorporating AI into their business model, which seems like all the studios want to do now. It's tough. You know what I mean? Like it's, can we not make a movie critiquing? Like, I'm not saying like every studio should be coming out with a movie critiquing AI and kind of the industry, but
why not A24? I want to know the explanation on that.
They
that
just did a big AI deal. They just did a big AI deal today.
I think. Yeah, they're on really? The board. Yeah. He's on a board with Altman, the guy who runs
A24. God, I didn't know that. Okay, yeah. Well, that fucking makes sense.
It's also like the movie just might not be very good. And that's also probably a factor. It's like, do you want to potentially fuck with any whatever your sponsor thinks and the movie's just not very good on top of it? And I mean, God bless Luca, like, are his movies some giant box office draws? Not really. Like, it's just, I feel like there's a cascading levels to it for sure. But I do agree, like, the whole everybody's seemingly not interested in an AI movie or a movie about Altman does seem a little strange, especially because Garfield alone should be like enough for the price of like, I should be interested, right?
No, this is one of my most anticipated of the year coming in, just based on like the cast, who's working behind the scenes, the subject matter. I thought it was big swing, but it could, if it lands, like be something really great. I mean, Luca's hit or miss, but when he hits, he really fucking hits. Like
but when he misses, he really fucking misses too.
Oh yeah,
that was a fucking.
Also, maybe this is he came out against the king of Hollywood, the king of movies, Mr. Movies, a week or two ago. Maybe Tom Cruise pulled the plug on this thing.
Honestly, good for Cruise getting that Scientology stuff to work.
Fuck you, Luca. You gonna talk shit about Top Gun? Fuck off.
That was crazy. That was such a crazy thing to say.
I don't mind it too much, to be honest. I like it.
I get.
He picked the worst example. He picked the worst fucking example for his main point. His main point wasn't terrible, but it was like saying like I hate how they shoot too many threes in the NBA. Look at Steph Curry. He sucks. It's like, no, he doesn't. You picked the one guy who makes it look really cool. Like you got to pick the example that sucks. Oh, it's crazy.
For me, a big part of it is, the reaction to it, I was more bothered by the people. Like, you can have both things, right? You can have a Luca Guadagnino movie, and you can have, like, I don't understand why there's a need to kind of rip it down, but that was his take.
We need more directors giving batshit takes.
Yeah, I would prefer more to be open like that. I don't have to agree with them, but.
Yeah, like Tarantino's got terrible takes, but I like listening to them. Takes. I like listening
apparently,
to them.
He apparently has seen Horizon 2 from Kevin Costner. Yeah, said he quite liked it. That's just fucking bullshit. I believe he's seen it, but like I don't believe Tarantino liked that movie. Give me a break.
No.
George Lucas apparently has a role in Minions and Monsters. Perfect. What's happening?
Perfect. I think that's
perfect. Are they just trying to preserve their... They're older in age, him, Scorsese. They're just trying to preserve themselves in like younger movies for their like grandkids and stuff like that.
Have a little fun. Do a little banana for the people. Like half of his characters are basically minions anyway in Star Wars.
Is he a minion? Like who is he voicing?
It's got to be.
He's replacing Blurb, Jeff.
Yep.
Herb.
Is he like... I need to know who George Lucas is. I don't know how that's like, is he is largely out of the public spotlight. Like he'll show up on red carpets. He's at the World Cup the other day. He just opened up that massive museum near USC's campus. But otherwise he's very like, not, I don't know. I need to know.
because it's going to be old Hollywood, like silent era in talkies, just like Babylon. I bet he plays a director. I bet he voices a director.
Sucking down a Diet Coke, directing a movie, like I with the big ass hair, I'd love it.
Yeah, that'd be clever.
I could see him doing a director. Speaking of directors, Jesse Eisenberg's movie title got announced. Yes. His next one, The Debut, stars, he's been produced, he's producing with Emma Stone. He wrote and directed it. Julianne Moore, Paul Giamatti, Halle Bailey. Forget who else is in it. But a shy woman is unexpectedly cast in a local production of an original musical. Under the spell of the strong-willed and enigmatic director, she loses herself in the role and the high-stakes world of this community theater production.
Very excited.
I'm more than anything he does after his last movie. So,
mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out to Emma Stone just financing his career now. That's great. She did A Real Pain, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. She forgot she did that.
Yeah, and she's finally free of Yorgos' clutches for like a little bit to go do her own thing.
He's doing something else I saw.
Yeah, but that doesn't involve her, which is like, I think, great for the personal growth of both of them.
Yes, I would agree.
And her marriage, probably.
Yes.
Time to do a little something, just a little something different. Yeah. But yeah, he did A Real Pain 2 years ago, and he's back for this next one. So very, very excited to see what he's got on tap. No more Now You See Me movies. Come on. Oh, he's also in Minions and Monsters.
Come on.
Eisenberg is?
One more Now You
See Me. Yeah, he's voicing Dort in Minions and Monsters.
Good for him. Respect.
Ah, Dort.
And then finally, Peter Serafinowicz,
tough defense,
who famously voiced Darth Maul, among many other things, had a very funny Star Wars story, which every time he talks about Star Wars, it's pretty funny. Because it was a horrible experience for him. It was a huge letdown. He voiced Darth Maul, didn't play Darth Maul, just voiced the character. He said he was told by George that he would be the next James Earl Jones, which is a pretty crazy thing to tell someone when you know they're going to die at the end of the movie. And then also have over under. Let's play a game here. How many words does Darth Maul say in The Phantom Menace?
They have that conversation, him and not the Emperor.
The conversation he talks to the Nemodians.
Yeah, like at nighttime.
Gunray.
Yeah, and he says like they say like three words to each other, like the finally the Jedi will be ours. Like I would say he says less than 20 lines in this movie.
Yeah, I was going to say 18.
There are 20 words roughly.
Six, maybe seven.
I'm going to say 17 words. Mm-hmm. So he says,
what does OpenAI say?
7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36. I'm guessing that's it.
36 words?
I don't think he speaks again after that.
He doesn't say shit during their duel at all. It's all silent.
37, 38, 39. Damn, I knew I should have guessed in like the high 20s. I would have been off. Yeah, he says 39 words the entire movie.
Because he talks to the Nemodians, then he talks to the Emperor at the nighttime like Coruscant scene, but I don't remember him speaking again.
Yeah, he says he's 39 total words were spoken by Darth Maul. And George Lucas told Peter Serafinowicz he's the next James Earl Jones.
I feel bad too, because Serafinowicz does have a great voice.
He does.
Very funny guy, too.
He's not voiced Darth Maul anymore. It's now voiced by
Sam Witwer.
Sam Witwer, yeah.
Witwer's got a great voice, too.
That has to feel bad, too.
Like,
yeah.
Like, that's one of the most respected voice acting performances I can think of in my lifetime.
Yeah. All right. What have you been watching lately? Anything?
Thrones. Off to a good start.
People seem to be very happy with the return of the House of the Dragon.
I think they should have, because this episode's like just one big battle, and I think they should have ended the last season. I know that was like a big point of contention between HBO and them about it. But like, I wish this episode was the ending of the last season and not the beginning of this one, because it throws you right in the middle of the action without like really refreshing you on the characters. And they just have 5 billion characters. And it's like, in Thrones, they're a lot more, I don't know, like judicious in how they deal. They split up the screen time between people. Like this is just all over the place and there's just too many people to keep track of. And that was a little bit of a bummer, but the fights were good. And that's where you really want, especially because last season was so boring.
Yeah, I have not watched yet. I will watch. I'm not
Widow's Bay, great.
As other people.
So. You did Widow's Bay too, right?
Say it again?
You did Widow's Bay too, right?
Widow's Bay, fantastic.
Really good. Really, really good.
Excellent, excellent, excellent show. Mm-hmm. Makes you wonder, and actually the Red Letter Media guys brought this up in their review of it, and this is kind of what I was thinking when I was watching Widow's Bay. Katie Dippold is the showrunner for the show, and yep. she did the female Ghostbusters movie, and it makes you wonder how much of that was really Paul Feig's fault more than anything.
Right.
Because she took a lot of shit for that movie. Rightfully so. It's a horrific movie. Terrible in every way, shape, and form. But this show was fantastic. They brought in some excellent directors too. They brought in Andrew DeYoung, who did the Tim Robinson movie Friendship.
Yep.
He also did Chair Company with Tim Robinson as well. And you can tell the episodes that he directed in this. They just have that like Tim, that like sicko weird Tim Robinson
delivery,
feel.
Yeah.
Ty West did an episode. Hiro, I don't know how you say his last name. Hiro Murray. He did. He worked on Atlanta. Barry. Worked on The Bear as well. Executive producer. He did a ton of the episodes of Widow's Bay as well. It's a great show. Very funny and very dry, but also like really good horror. And I won't spoil it, but the episode that was my favorite, I think, was I'll say Boogeyman episode. Like just a crazy out of nowhere episode for that show. So yeah, I highly suggest that. Have you guys watched Cape Fear at all?
Not yet. I want to. It hurts really good.
Yeah, it's getting a lot of good reviews. I haven't watched it, but it's getting a lot of hype. That's kind of next on my list. People seem to quite like it.
Yeah.
And I don't do that show Sugar on Apple TV.
It's
tough deciding which Apple TV show you're going to watch. They have a lot of really, you know, like the floor on all those shows is so high. Like, you know, you're going to probably watch something good when you click play. But there's like so many coming out all the time, and it's kind of tough to decide where you're going to spend your time.
Yeah,
I'm excited to start Cape Fear because I've seen mixed things, but I've seen some people swear by it, but then some people say like didn't really do anything for me. That's got Amy Adams, Javier Bardem, Patrick Wilson, so I'll definitely check that one out. Mm-hmm. Anything else on what we've seen?
No, nothing crazy for me.
Yeah, no. Pretty busy the last week. Did a lot of rewatching. Spielberg rewatching, Toy Story rewatching, but outside of that.
Yeah, I snuck in some Toy Story stuff. Got a couple things in the mail. Got probably way too much if we're being completely honest. Umbrella, The Fall. This has been a huge blind buy recommendation to me. Watched it. Unbelievable movie. Fucking incredible box set. Umbrella is like big time, like great boutique label. Comes with like hardbound books. You get the book, you get the behind the scenes content as well. I'm just fucking hiding it here. You get like a full book, make of the movie, you get essays and everything, and looks fantastic. Tarsem Singh's The Fall, which I had not seen. Watch it yesterday. Fucking incredible movie. Very glad I got that. Umbrella's, they got some fantastic stuff. And then I also got second version of Mean Streets from Second Sight. It's the definitive Mean Streets from Scorsese. Found a 1 of 100 Oppenheimer. I'm now just collecting every version of Oppenheimer and Sinners that I can possibly find. Those are like the two. I just like everything. And Dune. But this is like crazy looking Oppenheimer.
Cool. Yeah, that one's cool.
Special edition 4K, which is only 100 in the world. Can't believe the guy got rid of it. Guy's a lunatic for getting rid of it. And then Curzon, I've not had many of this label, but the Three Colors trilogy from Curzon is beautiful, I had to get it because this is like, I mean, some of the best shit ever made. One of the best trilogies ever made.
For sure.
And I have the Criterion, but wanted to pick this one up as well. A couple new Criterions came out this week. They announced the 12 Angry Men going to 4K, which I'm very excited to see how that looks in 4K. Because the Blu-ray looks great, but I'm curious how it looks like in the 4K kind of remaster. So
see the other big announcement? Better start saving up. I know. Yeah,
so here's my concern. So they're coming out with a Kubrick box set, Criterion.
Let's go.
My concern is, I obviously have a lot behind me, but I have one rule. No goofy fucking box sets. The Wes Anderson box set is preposterous. It's just ridiculous. It's like this, and there was a leak of what the Wes Anderson almost looked like, and it's like just normal. You can put it on a shelf. This thing is like, it looks like a fucking record player. It's just got these like, it's like a briefcase. It's just too big. And they've had some other things. Like, I think their Fellini box set is massive, right? You have it?
Right here.
It's
got record. Another box. Cool. It's like, that comes out of the box. It's got like, yeah, it's got just, those it's essays just, and stuff.
It's just, and even this, like, I picked up this. Like, I got the film vaults, like The Shining. This is too big.
So you just don't like how it fits on the shelf.
Yeah, like, there's a little bit of, like, well, I want it to fit on a shelf. Like, it's you know, it's like... Imagine one of I ordered a Kubrick thing a couple years ago, and it's like this big. So I'm a little worried that the Kubrick thing is going to be this monstrosity. But it is funny because like I buy a lot of things on Discord and Reddit and eBay, and people are unloading their Kubricks. They're just and all the comments are like, "Why are you getting rid of this? why are you getting rid of this one?" So yeah, I'm curious what it is. Kubrick, look. I know my guy Stanley. He'd want it simple. He wouldn't want a big fucking coffee table book that folds out into his head, bust of him. None of that. All right, top 10. Let's do a revote of our Spielberg list. This was incorrect last week. That's my fault. I left off E.T. Top 10 with my E.T. included goes Jaws, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Schindler's List, The Last Crusade, Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, Catch Me If You Can, Close Encounters, West Side Story.
Still great.
Yeah, that's crazy. I forgot it.
I think West Side Story actually ended up getting bumped by Duel because I ended up putting Duel in my top 15.
Okay.
And
okay.
It was so that was across the board for everyone.
Yeah, Duel is great. Duel for me, I think, was like top 15 as well.
We all had it. Our rankings, by the way, were just like, I think it was the most aligned we'd ever been. Like across
yeah, for the
board,
most part,
everyone,
you don't have E.T. as high.
No, I was low on E.T. I think me and Kirk like were swapped on E.T. and Jurassic Park. Like yes. I had Jurassic Park at 2 and he had it at 14. And then he had E.T. at 2 and I had it at 14.
Yep. Obviously, Jaws is our first unanimous number one. So, all right, these guys interviewed Craig Gillespie. Big release from coming up. Supergirl. Very excited for it. Here's our interview.
Okay, we are very happy to be joined by the one and only Craig Gillespie to talk about Supergirl, Kara Zor-El, or is it Kara or Kara? I was Kara. Kara Zor-El, aka Supergirl. Let's go Supergirl. Supergirl. We were just saying right before we started, sometimes Kryptonian can get a little over my head. Joins forces with an unlikely companion on an interstellar journey of vengeance and justice when an unexpected adversary strikes too close to home, June 26th, Supergirl. What I think one of the many great things about the movie is that you guys really struck a home run with Millie Alcock as Supergirl. She is so fantastic, so great. And you signed on actually after the casting. I'm curious how much of it was influenced by that. You guys already getting like you got the girl.
No, it's funny. It's like that is the single most hottest thing to do, to find the lead for a film, particularly this kind of film. And I got to go in and meet James after he'd already cast Millie. So knowing that that was the tone they wanted to go with, to have like an actor of her caliber, I think her performances have been brilliant prior to that. I'd watched her in House of the Dragon and several Australian television shows. I could see like the dance she did between drama and humor. And I couldn't be more excited. I couldn't even think of anybody else that would be right for the role besides her. Mm-hmm. So knowing that that was what they were going for made it really exciting to step into.
I didn't even think about the Australian connection before we thought about it. But yeah, and it's so funny. You guys are getting really pervasive in Hollywood. You guys are everywhere.
No, it definitely was a little Australian camaraderie going on set, I think. And there's a sense of humor that maybe sometimes it was too Australian.
Mm-hmm. No, we'll talk actually a little bit about what I felt I saw a little Australian influence in a specific movie. We'll talk about that in a bit. What I really liked about the way you guys handled the character, I think, is that you establish this iteration of Supergirl where she's a great yin to Superman's yang,
yeah.
especially when you have them on screen together, which is so great. And I was curious how important that contrast in characters was for you guys in setting them up.
Well, it's built into the story. Anna Nagari wrote an amazing script off of a Tom King's graphic novel, obviously. But she is quite the contrarian, and she's running away from her trauma. She's running away from responsibility. And it all makes sense from what her upbringing was and like what the loss that she suffered. And she was never groomed for this role where Superman was. So that conflict was built in the best way, and being able to play with that and the altruism of Superman versus her lack of responsibility that she has mm-hmm. makes for some great scenes.
Yeah, especially every time they're on screen together, it's like, oh, this just is right.
You feel that so sibling rivalry, even though they're cousins.
Exactly. Cousins that met like pretty late into their lives, yeah. and it's like immediate, like it just works right away. You mentioned James Gunn. I feel, and we've talked about this like long before you had ever signed on for Supergirl, like you and James Gunn feel like such a match made in heaven, because the way it feels like you guys approach, Jesus Christ, the way you guys approach movies does feel very similar in that you guys are really, really great. I would say maybe the best. And especially integrating music into your pictures.
Right.
I'm kind of curious like what your guys' meeting was like and like how you guys felt about it.
I was so excited that James got to head up the DC universe because I love his tone and I've loved the work that he's done. And I do feel a kinship with the kind of style that he's doing and the tone that it's always a tricky tone. I love to be in a tricky tone with space, and music is obviously close to my heart. When I met with him, which was at the beginning of this, all of this happening, I had to pitch myself as a director. They were meeting multiple directors at the time. And I asked him, I said, how much do you want this to be in your universe that you're doing right now with Superman? They were in the middle of shooting. And he's like, not at all. Mm-hmm. And which I was candidly surprised by. He's like, we're treating this like each one is its own graphic novel. And they're as distinct as graphic novels are in the comic universe. And you get to do what you do. And that was an amazing gift that he gave. It was also a little scary because this is a whole world that we had to create.
Yeah.
It was all off planet. It's a universe. I didn't quite appreciate the enormity of that. 50 different aliens, wardrobe, locations. It was an enormous undertaking. And he was amazingly true to his word.
Yeah.
And then again, in post, we got to like sort of roll our sleeves up together. And that's a really fun process to be like dealing with a filmmaker instead of a studio.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
So to be able to be like, well, what if we tried this? Or what if we cut this out? Or what if we moved? That kind of dialogue, it's such a shorthand that you have amongst filmmakers.
Yeah. I imagine it's almost like being an actor's director. What I mean?
But exactly,
in this case,
you
have the guy that like he understands from where you're coming from.
Yeah. And the music, and it's like everything. There's it's like, well, what if you drop the music here and like do this? Well, we'll cut out right now. It's like,
I imagine too, because this is early days for like the update to DC. I'm kind of curious how important it is for you guys to kind of match your visual acumen at all. Because like, obviously you want to look similar, like you're still in the same world, but you also want to establish your own independent identity. So.
Well, that was from the get go, like when I came in and met on this movie, it's very hard to second guess people. And I think you got to stay true to your own instincts. So for me, I put together this deck, 120 pages of visuals of what I wanted to do. And if they didn't want to do that, no harm, no foul. But sure. Like, you don't want to get down the road and suddenly be like, hang on, well, what movie are you making? Mm-hmm. it's a terrible place to be. So I wanted to be as upfront and clear as possible of what I thought this should be. And it was dark and gritty. And the cinematography of it, just the style of it. It's like I pushed in that first meeting that let's have a not get into the superhero outfit till as late as possible, mm-hmm. which wasn't in the script. And he leaned in on all of that. And so that to have that kind of confidence and be able to run with that was amazing. And I kept waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah, right.
And it didn't. We ended up shooting the whole thing, and it was like, that Bible was kind of for all the departments, and we just marched forward and got it done. And that was really special. And
so it's so funny because this is like the opposite experience. I remember we interviewed Matthew Vaughn for something a long time ago, he was Kingsman. And he talked about his experience on like Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he describes it is the exact opposite. We were trying to deal with like a studio where it's like they're overbearing. They're telling you need to cut this and move this. And it sounding like such a collaborative experience with Gunn feels like a relief. Comparatively,
I think absolutely, and it's like it's it's an interesting thing because there's a lot at stake, you know.
Exactly.
So the people you usually do feel the pressure.
Yeah.
You know, trickling down.
We actually had a few months ago, Jason Momoa was sitting in the exact seat you're sitting right now. And we asked him a lot about getting the call for this. And he mentioned how when Zack Snyder called him initially for Aquaman, like he gets the call. He's like, I want you to be in this movie. And he's like, oh, you want me to be Lobo, right? And he's like, no, I want you to be Aquaman. He's like, oh, okay, cool. But Lobo's cool too, though. So how amped up was he to get the call from you guys? Like,
it literally came up in the first meeting with right about Jason.
Yeah.
You know, with James and Peter. And he's been championing it for 15 years, Jason. So I couldn't imagine anybody else in the role. And he came into it with such enthusiasm and gusto. And, you know, a lot of, conversations. He's probably the biggest Lobo fan there is.
Oh, yeah.
There's been decades of Lobo comics, like trying to single it out of like, all right, so what's his look? Mm-hmm. What's it going to be? And we quickly like landed in the 90s. With the look and trying to really stay true to that character and his lineage and where these like facial markings come from. And there was a lot of great discussions, but then to get him on set and his energy, and he's so gregarious in the best way and his willingness to play, you know, like try something completely different and find the character was so much fun.
Yeah. It's funny. We were talking about that with Momoa and like, cause you see in his early work, like, a very specific source of characters, but then like we watched Fast and Furious when he plays like basically the Joker, and we're like, oh my god, this guy can riff, he can do this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel like you could definitely get a lot of that.
Obviously, we're seeing that range now all over the place with him, which is amazing to see.
Yeah, it's very cool. And he actually, you mentioned like the stylized look. Like I felt like he almost regularly dresses like a human Lobo. Like he has like just this, a very unique like visual like style to himself. So
he does. He does indeed. And it's like when we And the other thing that happened with him, like, you know, so I wanted this movie to be as practical as possible.
Sure.
And I'm like, okay, I want Lobo's bike to work. I want him to be able to ride it through a whole stunt team, 50 like people on the set, fireballs going off and like do these power turns. Mm-hmm. And Jason was, of course, loved that and was totally up for it. And we built this bike that, you know,
that
worked. And so those sequences where you see him riding that bike, he's riding that bike through those crowds and those explosions.
Oh. That's awesome. We mentioned that too when we left the screening yesterday. The practical sets, especially when you see like aliens show up on scene.
Yeah.
And you could see like, well, obviously there's CG where like there needs to be CG, which feels like such a sort of breath of fresh air, especially in the comic book world where it felt like there was like an overabundance. And now it feels like it's like, let's be more, I don't know, judicious with our shots.
Yeah.
Because like, especially with the aliens, you get a lot of practical up to here.
Yeah.
And then maybe just the eyes.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But I love that touch.
Yeah. Legacy did a lot of our key visual effects and it's all animatronics for them. But they're great too with like the handover where it's like, you know, the blinks and the eyes toning, we can do CG, but like, let's make it as practical as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And find that line.
We loved that. And that's something we talk about a lot with like Star Wars too, where like, I feel like audiences, sometimes maybe studios, there was a certain point, maybe post-2000s, where like audiences love CG, they want a lot of CG, but I do feel like audiences do like a lot of practical work. Like there's a suspension of disbelief for animatronics and puppets, which like audiences do seem to have.
Which they don't for CG.
Yeah, which they now, it's flipped and it's on the opposite
end. It's flipped, but the other thing I'd say, and I think all practical effects, it's the same with the stunts. Like we built that stage for that big fight sequence.
Yeah.
On the biggest stage in Leavesden in London. So we built that whole city around them. And we had 7 tanks in there, one of them blowing 40 feet in the air with explosions, Lobo on his bike. The stunt team had 8 miles of cable ratcheting.
Jeez.
Stunt guys. My stunt coordinator, Rob Inch, came over and he's like, I've never used this much cable in a film before. And so it's as practical as we can make it.
Yeah.
With just set extensions up above. And I think the audience appreciates that. I think it's like they're so savvy now that they can just tell like what's CG, when's the blue screen, and you know, and it kind of takes you out of it. It's like, but there's just a tactile feeling to something when it's in camera.
Absolutely.
Can't deny.
It's absolutely a perfect way of putting it. And I think you feel that a lot, especially on these sets, like the bar, for example. You have a big bar sequence. Like you can that feels like a real bar, like a dingy real bar.
You can look 360. It's like that again, characters in that bar. If they're flying out a door, they're getting ratcheted out.
Yeah, they're getting blown up. You're seeing big stuff, and like it's like you're saying the tactile. Like you feel like you could reach out and touch it.
Yeah.
Versus like sometimes if it's a blue screen, like you don't really feel that immersion. Maybe as much. So just kind of curious with Supergirl, maybe just in coming approaching this in general, What are the comic book movies that inspired you, or some comic book pictures, or maybe just anything that inspired you in this process?
Well, this is kind of like a Buddy Road film. Mm-hmm. Obviously, True Grit has that, you know, is a favorite of mine, and just to know that you can have, and in fact, Logan has it as well. You know, you can have like this anti-hero that can be so gruff and unapologetic and put upon, mm-hmm. and the audience will go with that. You know, it's like, particularly when you understand why they're that way and what they're coming from emotionally. So just working with that, with those characters, is a really fun space to be in. I mean, obviously there's a ticking clock in the violence in John Wick, which is another touchstone, although it's different, but you know, in terms of a plot device, mm-hmm. it's, you know, you can't deny that.
You also have a great alien Noah and Space They Can't Hear You Scream moment too, which I also appreciated quite a bit. That was also great. Yeah, and I liked just the sort of visual you got for Krypton was cool, because you don't really get any of it in Superman.
No.
And that's something I think in most Superman origin stories, they'd make a point, like, we got to show you, even in like Man of Steel and whatever, like, they show you, like, here's a bunch of Krypton, but they really throw you right into the action, which I appreciate a lot in Superman, but you give it a little more context to what Clark might be feeling too.
Yeah, no, it was really great to like be able to roll our sleeves up and spend time there. Mm-hmm. And like really see this whole story and how it unfolded and why she is who she is. Yeah. And it was an interesting way, like when we were doing it, it kept moving around within the film of like, when do we reveal this to the audience? Cause like, how long can we go with her being abrasive and like rejecting and like other people and like running away from things before we need to understand why, mm-hmm. you know? So that was like a really interesting dynamic in the film to figure out.
Yeah. So Supergirl, June 26th, obviously have to talk to you about other stuff where we can. You also directed Cruella, which for my money's worth, and I've said this at least on our show a million times, it is the best Disney live action adaptation made, period. And I'm kind of curious, because you, I feel, had a very clear understanding of what made a live action adaptation work, and that you had something to say. You're like, I want to make my own spin on this, my own story, my own, give you something other than what you've already seen, which I really appreciated. But I'm kind of curious what your formula you think is for the live action remake, why you think it works.
With Disney in particular?
Sure, just live Disney action. Just live action remake. Yeah.
It's like, I was saying it on the Cruella with every department head when they would come in. And it's no offense to Disney, but I'm like, we're not making a Disney movie.
Sure.
We're making an independent film. Mm-hmm. Like, just think of it that way. Like, everything about it, the way we approach every, like fashion choice, like production design, it's like keep it as grounded and, you know, and real as we can. And it was a similar thing when we got to do Supergirl. It was like just the grit that, you know, diving in with Rob Hardy on cinematography and just the world that they're in. It's just, I wanted to feel the texture of it and the dirt and the poverty, mm-hmm. and the violence and just like feel like we're in it. And that's, again, like a little bit more back to that independent spirit, mm-hmm. and then have it on this enormous backdrop.
Yeah. And make something that I think that has not necessarily been seen yet, which I think is the smart way to go about it. And then in I, Tonya, obviously, this, I think that movie, you walked on such a tightrope, it felt, because you have a real story that had real consequences. It was like very serious event, but also you were able to inject a lot of humor into it. I'm kind of curious what your guys' approach was to that.
That was a stressful approach in a sense. And it's funny, my first meeting with Margot Robbie on that film, her one question was like, how are you going to handle the violence? Mm-hmm. And I said, I think it has to be brutal. I think we have to show like what she went through so we understand the way she is.
Absolutely.
Because she never quite gets to the point of being able to have the awareness in the movie of what she, of facing the consequences. Mm-hmm. But when you see what she suffered through, you understand why she can't quite get there.
Yeah.
And it gives you empathy for her and what she's been through. And I think, and amazingly, Margot didn't shy away from that at all.
Mm-hmm. Which I think helps make it work. Otherwise, I feel like it would feel, I don't want to say gross, it would feel like weird watching it. But like, because she, like, I think embraces that, you definitely, I don't know, it helps you build more empathy for her. You also cast and helped kick off the career of a guy we've had on the show many, many times, and Paul Walter Hauser.
Yes.
I would love to know what the audition process was like with him.
I remember it so well. He came in. And he basically delivered, because there's so much footage online of all of these people, and he delivered this brilliant performance of an interview of the actual person. And he's so not that. Mm. And to see him then just stop, and we chatted after that, but he gave it such complexity and nuance and vulnerability that I immediately knew he was the guy. What I didn't know as much, and he talked about this, Paul, first take with him on the set, he improvised.
Oh, really?
And he said he could hear me laughing behind the camera. I like to be as close as I can to them. He could hear me laughing, and he was like, okay, I'm okay. He's like, he's not mad. and Paul improvises all the time, and it's so great to be, he improvised. Margot immediately came back with him, and the banter started, and you got Sebastian there just like ping-ponging between the two of them, looking kind of pissed off. And I'm like, is he actually pissed off right now that he's doing this, or is he's in it, character?
Yeah.
And I realized he was in character as we went along, but to have him do that, and again on Cruella, it's like there was a moment on Cruella where I walked over after like six takes, and I'm like, hey, can we just try the script? And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, no, it's great. I love it. It's like, we should just get the script once, yeah.
It's funny. Last time he interviewed him, he said something like that, where he was on Black Klansman. Uh-huh. And he's like, I like to improv. But then I was like, it's Spike Lee. Like, I don't know if I can improv. And then he like tried it. And Spike Lee was like, all right, you could do this. So he's like, yeah, you got it. You know what you're doing here.
Yeah, there would be times like on Cruella, for instance, where I would just give him the improvising of like, they're doing a very simple birthday scene, and I go over to Paul and I hand him a cake, and I'm like, by the way, it's stolen. And I just give him that little piece of advice.
And he just runs with it?
Yeah. And then Emma comes right back with it.
Oh, I love Emily. That. He's an absolute delight.
Yeah.
I'd love to give you some rapid fire questions too. Some nice little fun ones. Is there a song that you've been dying to put in a movie, but you just haven't found the right opportunity yet? It's a song you love.
I've put so many songs in movies at this point. There's a Led Zeppelin song, which they're so hard to get.
Oh yeah, the rights, I'm sure, are impossible.
So that's like, that's, he's been in and taken out a couple of times.
Gotcha.
But outside of that, no.
Yeah,
I've been very lucky. In fact, on I, Tonya, it was a sort of a blow by blow to get each one of those songs.
Oh yeah,
because to that point that you made earlier, people heard Tonya Harding and they didn't want to be involved, and then. We ended up getting this amazing supervisor, Sue Jacobs, and Dire Straits had said no. Fleetwood Mac, Supertramp, they'd all said no. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, I don't know Dire Straits, but I know Mark Koffler. I have his email. Okay. So she sent him the first 12 minutes. My wife had found the song Romeo and Juliet when we were in prep, and she's like, this needs to be in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's in that first, scene. It's quite a violent scene. We sent it to Mark. And then he emailed back, send me the movie. And then we sent the movie to him. And he's like, all right, you can use the song. Mm-hmm. And then we go to like Fleetwood Mac. He's like, Dire Straits is in.
Now it's like a domino after that?
Yeah.
Like they said yes. Are you going to go?
And so we managed to get everything, that was originally in the film, which is amazing.
I will say that if you're now in the superhero world, the last time I heard a Led Zeppelin song in a movie was a superhero movie. I think it was Thor Ragnarok with Taika. They used Immigrant Song.
So he managed to get it.
Yeah. So if you're in the right zone right now. So if there's ever a world, you're in the right area right now. What is the most difficult scene you ever had to shoot? Like the hardest, gave you the most fits, whatever, production problems, whatever.
Wow. That's probably, it's funny. It's a good question, but it's probably just the exhaustion of Finest Hours, because that was 3 months.
Oh, on the water.
On the water. Yeah. In the rain, freezing cold rain. And nonstop for 3 months, and physically just that was the most exhausting. That and the other extreme, which we shot Million Dollar Arm in India,
burning heat
in 125 degree weather in the middle of summer.
Jesus Christ, that's brutal. What are some of the movies or directors that inspired you growing up?
It was The Shining. Was definitely
Shining. Excellent.
I remember that at 15, and it just completely, it completely changed my world. I almost know that movie frame for frame. Mm-hmm. And again, he has this amazing ability between humor and drama.
Yeah.
Whether it's that or any of all of his films, they always have this incredible dance. That would have to be the one. It's like definitely influenced by the Mad Max films as a young course. Australian.
Yeah.
But they're the first ones that come to mind. I wasn't one of these young filmmakers, like growing up as a teenager, being I'm going to be a director. It didn't happen for me till my 20s. Mm-hmm. And that was with commercials. And then I started doing commercials. And then I started thinking, you know what? I think I'd like to do features. Mm-hmm. And I was amazingly lucky enough to get the opportunity.
It's crazy. Like, I don't think a lot of, at least maybe even our audience member knows, like A lot of commercial directors go on to become like huge, massive directors. It is crazy. Like we just
interviewed. There was definitely a period in, you know, the 70s and the 80s with like Ridley Scott. And,
yeah, of course. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Adrian like Lyon. We just interviewed Gore Verbinski. Like Gore Verbinski was doing like
Gore and
like all these random.
David Fincher was.
Yeah, like, Fincher was doing them. Like all these actors were or directors.
Spike Jones.
Yeah. Oh, man. I love more Spike Jones commercials. Yeah. He's still so good. He did one with Zendaya recently that was amazing for I think Apple or something. So good. If you get a blank check to create any movie in the entire world that you want, what would you make it about? Very broad question.
You know what? There's actually, it's funny. I would love to do my Gangs of New York for Australian convicts.
Oh, so you'd do like Ned Kelly gang type thing?
Or? No, no. It's more the actual like Sydney as a whole. It's like
gotcha.
Australia in the first 30 years, they just plopped a bunch of convicts down there. Hmm. And it was absolute chaos. And for the first 30 years, there was no currency.
Oh.
Everything was bartered on rum and sex.
That's so, I never even knew. I knew obviously the convict stories. I didn't know anything about that. But that's cool. There's a lot of like, I feel Australian cinema work, or maybe Australian stories working their way more into the mainstream now too. Yeah. I think there's a spot for that. I love Ned Kelly Gang too. That was also a really good movie. Speaking of, what are some Australian movies that you think more Americans should watch?
You're throwing me under the bus there.
It could be. I mean, the answer could be as easy as Mad Max. It could be something as, because now a lot of Americans, I would say, have seen something like Fury Road, but maybe haven't seen the original.
I'm a huge Peter Weir fan, and so you know, The Witness, but they're not necessarily Australian movies.
Sure.
But I think his films are timeless. Mm. Master and Commander. And
I love Master and Commander. You know, God. So good.
And obviously, and the same with the Mad Max films. It's like, I think it's amazing that he is still doing these films in his 80s, and I think he schooled everybody as action directors.
So rewatching, every time I rewatch Master and Commander, I'm like, how did they not make 50 of these? Because they have the book series is lengthy. They had so much to work off of, but they just, I guess, I don't know if Pirates of the Caribbean.
Society. He had just an amazing like run of films.
So, so great. And I would highly, and also I recommend sometimes to people Gallipoli, because I feel like a lot of Americans know the story Gallipoli. Yeah.
I should have said that one.
Yeah.
I should have started with Gallipoli.
Gallipoli should have been the first one. Yeah. and then lastly, what is something that you have been watching or maybe listening to that you think more people should watch?
I'm absolutely loving, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, but The Widow's Bay.
I was going to suggest it when you said earlier, The Shining. I was like, you should check out Widow's Bay.
I'm loving it. It just killed it.
Comedy, horror.
It's that beautiful tonal dance, and Hero's done an amazing job with it.
Oh, my God.
And Andrew DeYoung, and
And Matthew Reese is just, you should see on social media, just because Widow's Bay has become so popular now, now everyone's going to watch The Americans now, and they're like, oh my God, where's this show? This is so good.
He's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, where is this guy?
And he's Welsh.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and then he's Welsh, and his wife is Carrie Russell, and they're just now, they're absolutely incredible. But again, Supergirl in theaters June 26th, make sure to check it out. I think most of our audience loved Superman, so I feel like you should. It's an obviously next step, natural next step in our evolution here. But thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Pixar rankings. Top 10 Pixar movies on as voted on by the three of us. here we go. Number 10. Everyone's got the top 10 in their list somewhere. Number 10. 12 on Gooch's list, 5 on Ken Jack's, 7 on mine. Toy Story 2. Which gets a little lost in the discussion, I feel like, sometimes.
Toy Story 2 rocks. You guys aren't as high on it?
I mean, I only have it 2 spots below you. I have it at 7. I mean, I quite like Toy Story 2.
For me, Pixar just has, like, tiers. Like, and the second tier is a very large grouping that just comes down to splitting hairs.
Hmm. I mean, it's excellent. Great, great villain, Stinky Pete. Al is a fantastic villain as well. Some really funny stuff. Really good proof of like what you can do with animated shit as well. Like even just like the scene of Woody walking around the cheese puffs. Mm-hmm. Like that's just great stuff.
Funnier as an adult too. I think when you I rewatched it kind of recently too, and like watching like the adult collector, because you could transpose that guy into like the Funko Pop guy that's like cutting kids in line at like a Toys R Us release. Like that guy is so prescient in adult society. And I think it's so funnier now as an adult versus as a kid. Because as a kid, I'm just looking at him as like a one-dimensional bad guy, whatever. But as an adult, I appreciate that character more.
Yeah, and they nailed the look. Like that, that guy. That guy's the most obvious toy collector, reseller ever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very funny movie.
He is in great Wayne Knight performance voice-wise from that character. Just fantastic stuff. And again, that's the side adventure stuff. that I think you're missing with 4 and 5 a little bit, especially 5. Like, you get the side characters heavily in this one. You get Ham, you get Mr. Potato Head, you get Slinky. Like, that's the shit, Rex. That's the shit I think you needed more of from this.
I think you get it in 5. I think it just comes from the other characters. The side characters now, the toilet paper thing and the you know, the geolocator and the whatever the other thing was. Like, it's those
yeah,
are now the
fair.
Side characters.
It's new side characters. That's fair to an extent. But it's like, man, it's like
you missed
there's
the
a little
guys, yeah.
bit of like, you got stuff that still works. Like, I just hate to have him take the back seat. But 2-2 is great.
I cannot recognize those as toys. Like, the potty trainer and the GPS pad, maybe the camera could be a toy.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Sure.
That's like, it's such a stretch to call those
but
toys.
But that's what they play with, because we didn't play with that, obviously, but they did.
Yeah, I guess, but did they? It's not play. It's not play.
I'm with you on that.
No. Yeah,
number
Jesse
nine.
Also, just like, that's great introduction of a character in this.
Oh,
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out Stinky Pete. Shout out the creepy scene, the creepy Stinky Pete blooper they cut out from Disney Plus, where he tells the Barbies, "I get you a role in Toy Story 3."
Yeah.
cut it out on Disney Plus. Number 9, 4 for me. You guys not as high. I think I think we're in masterpiece territory with a couple of these, and this is one of them. That's WALL-E. Ken Jack 10, Gooch 9. Mm. I love WALL-E. WALL-E is basically a silent movie to an extent. But has so much to say. Again, I mean, you used the word earlier. You want to talk about Pixar saying profound things? Like, this is one of those. Just has just so much to say. It is absolutely fantastic. I fucking love WALL-E.
Probably the closest they've came within Pixar to being like a Miyazaki movie, where it's like,
for
we
sure.
have kid stuff, but it's going to be all about like environmental.
Very adult too.
Yeah, like, but it's still like very good.
Outside of Soul, probably their most adult thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that might be what brings it down in the rankings for me, which probably unfair to it, but, you know, it's tough because, you know, I give Miyazaki and Studio G like that leeway to be more adult that I don't know if I give that to Pixar. Maybe that's just because I grew up on the Toy Story movies and it was always geared at children, and then trying to reconcile with it, you know, aging with me, doesn't fully connect, but I recognize that it is brilliant. Maybe like in terms of what they're going for, might be their biggest home run ever. Like, cause it was nominated for Best Picture, right? Am I off the mark on that one?
WALL-E was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Also features the only human in the, shout out Fred.
That's true.
Fred Willard, the only human to ever appear.
That's true. Was WALL-E? No, actually, I don't think WALL-E was nominated for Best Picture.
It wasn't?
No, because WALL-E was what, 2000? WALL-E's one of those movies that would have been.
Well, let me
take a look. I know Up was.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It is, I think, a great melding of both.
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't, because you know what it was? It was the Dark Knight year.
Oh, 08.
Right? That would have been the year of the Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like a good that's actually very quietly a good example of like Dark Knight and WALL-E should have been nominated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so WALL-E number 9. Speaking of Up, number 8 is Up. 13 for Gooch, 9 for Ken Jack, 3 for myself. Beautiful movie.
Really?
Unbelievable opening scene. Fantastic characters. Russell, the fucking old man.
Balloon Jerry.
Balloon Jerry,
we call them for a long time. So it's his name. It's fucking Balloon Jerry. Just a great movie with excellent music. Like,
really good soundtrack.
If we ranked Pixar themes, like Up might be my favorite.
Really, really good.
I think Up's my favorite. Another great performance by an old actor with Ed Asner playing Balloon Jerry, aka Carl Fredrickson. Glad they never went back to try and make more on this. I hope they never do. Perfect as is. And just looks. I think Pixar's best looking movie, like a beautiful movie to look at. The image of that house in the clouds is just next level.
Yeah, and just the opening you mentioned it is like It's just incredible. Like that opening is perfect. It's one of the most like impressively emotionally manipulative things I've ever seen.
Big
like,
time.
It fucking just works. It, like if that doesn't work on you, then you are heartless.
I have heard of this take, and I worked with some people back in the work in Morning America. There, we had this big fight one day, argument about Pixar, and one of my coworkers said this, and people agreed that they think that after the opening, Up is kind of mediocre from there on out. I don't agree with that.
It's not as good, but it's not mediocre.
Mm. Kind of falls off. It's kind of tracks a little bit after. I don't think so at all. Good villain. Voiced by Christopher Plummer.
Yeah,
a dynamite duo that is. Ed Asner, Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, double RP.
Yeah, so fantastic movie. Up is at number 8. Number 7, 4 for Ken Jack, 6 for Gooch, 11 for me, though, again, like, being top 15 on this is, like, almost impossible. That's Finding Nemo.
Mm. That's only registered hard with me.
High for you, Ken Jack, number 4.
Yeah, that one just registered with me very hard. And I think I love the voice crew on this. Like, Albert Brooks, I think he just has such a great personable voice, which I think has helped them both in other movies. Like we talked about this, I think, even in the last episode, like Defending Your Life. Like I just love him, and then I feel it across the screen. Ellen too, but whatever. And I mean, the rest of the voice cast I think is also very solid. But also, it's colorful, bright, good messaging. Like you feel your heartstrings being pulled very heavily throughout it. A similar opening in a way to Up, I guess. But also, like it gets you really heavily. I think towards the end, and a lot of good quotes coming out of it. Like Just Keep Swimming, I think always will work. But yeah, love Finding Nemo.
Yeah, I think I was just the right age for this to
same
to hit the way it did. I think it's also just hilarious. Like it was very, very fucking funny. And I think Ellen's
great character, great voice cast.
Yeah. Yeah. Willem Dafoe, hot fish. Come on.
Yeah.
Sexy ass fish. And like just like animated, there is something to animated films being set in marine life that works. Mm-hmm. Just very magical world.
Even like Shark Tale, like all those movies, like I'm into it. I'm just like, I like that big, colorful clownfish. Like, I'll love all that shit.
Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Ponyo. The number one thing for me with this list, and I kind of want to, and I'm sure you guys have a very similar thing. The difference between, I mean, like the top 10 is still like some of the best movies I've ever seen. It's like, it is pretty crazy. So Finding Nemo, number 7. 6, Inside Out. Number 5 for me, 8 for Ken Jeong, 7 for Gooch. This might be their best attempt at doing adults and kids crossover. Like, yeah, like this is like, it, like you could probably take, Toy Story 3 is up there, but Toy Story 3 is kind of more nostalgia-based for that sense, and that's not a knock on Toy Story 3. But like you could take Soul and be like, okay, what percentage of this is adult? And I would say probably like 80 to 90% of it. Inside Out, you could pull out the adult and the kid of Inside Out, and it's like 100% kid, 100% adult. Like it's almost like you could say both. And that's kind of the brilliance of Inside Out, which is another great voice cast movie that has a lot to say. And just it's the inventive Pixar that you're like, God, that's fucking, how the fuck did they think of that? Like, that's just unbelievable. Like the ideas meeting for Inside Out, whoever ran that meeting just cooked. I mean, just was that must be like throwing 10 perfect games. They must have been like, holy shit, this guy is on fire right now.
Mm-hmm. Smart, really good lore. I like the set, like the sort of a build, the build of like how everything looked, like beautiful to look at. Great voice cast too, on top of all that. And a lot of like heart string pulling moments. Like, what's fucking Bing Bong dying? Richard Kine, like, holy shit, dude, I want to like die watching that. But yeah, really, really good movie. And the sequel is good too.
Pete Docter directed it. Pete Docter also directed and wrote Toy Story, wrote Toy Story 2, directed and wrote Monsters, Inc., wrote WALL-E, directed and wrote Up, directed and wrote Inside Out, directed and wrote Soul, has not done really anything since then. He has. He's like the executive producer on almost everything with Pixar. He is the CCO of Pixar. But, I mean, I assume he was the one cooking in that meeting. But good Lord, that is just like...
Yeah.
Such a good concept. Really
crazy
is.
Good concept. Mm-hmm. Next one, Monsters, Inc., number 5. 9 for me, 7 for Ken Jeong, 3 for Gooch. Gooch, big Mike Wazowski fan.
It's so funny. It's maybe Billy Crystal's voice performance. I fucking love that. Like, it's so, so good. And another concept, which I think is just brilliant. And I do think plays across generations. Like, it does play to an older crowd as well. The monsters are great. I think all the character designs are really great. Like, way out there, but work so well. And the little girl is just adorable. Boo, so cute.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. Like, I feel like it just got lost in the shuffle too heavily because there's so many bangers coming out from the studio at that point. Like, it is really, really funny. And, like, it would have been the best animated movie for, like, a lot of other studios. That's how funny it was. And I agree with you. Crystal, I think something about Crystal's performance, it really gets me every time. Yep. It's just really funny. Just like, he has the perfect, like, complaining voice. You know what I mean? For that character, it just works really well for me. And the monster designs are all cool, too.
Yep, great, great movie. Is Monster University great? No, but I still enjoy it as well. Like, it's still a fun movie. Concept, you know, how things work, it's the world building. And there's one movie that didn't make this list, which someone does have in their top 10, which I will roast in a moment, but also allow that person to give it flowers. That movie doesn't work because it doesn't make any sense. Nothing, like, we'll get to it in a minute. It's not in the top 10. Number four is Toy Story 3, which I have at number 2, which I have recently bumped up to a 100 out of 100 on my movie rankings. It's perfect.
So good.
It's just unbelievable. But Gooch, you have it at 10.
Yeah. Like I said, like, there's so many great movies here that I really do like to reward original. Like, if I was, like, going off, like, merit based and just, like, how well made is this and how well written is this? This is a top 5 Pixar movie, but there is just a magic to being introduced to a world for the first time. It's hard to replicate. And while this does pull on those nostalgia strings better than I think almost any sequel across mediums
without steamrolling itself either.
Like, yeah, like, it's really, really well done in terms of the nostalgia. I do like being introduced to a new world, but this is a
think about what the concept for Toy Story 3, what they did. They're like, hey, we're going to play into nostalgia. And then someone at the meeting speaks up and goes, is Andy going to find the original box that Buzz came in? Something like that. Is that what's going to happen? Now we're going to, like, almost kill them.
Incinerate, like,
what the
most traumatic way possible.
Nah, we're going to put them an inch from death. Like, hold
hands.
Shit. Yeah. Holding hands. Holy shit.
And it goes on. And it
Jeff is getting choked up.
It goes on for a long time, too, because when they first get in that conveyor belt, you're like, they're going to get out of this pretty quick, right? You're like, oh, fuck. Because then even in that moment, you're like, they're not going to kill them. But you're like,
this is the end. You're like, this is number 3. Like,
again, this is where Pixar is good. Pixar challenges a lot of things. It challenges kids, challenges adults, and it challenges kids. Because in that moment, it's like, if you're a dumb kid, you're like, oh, my God, they're dead. In an adult, I'm like, they're going to save them. But even part of me, when I remember watching, I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, you're seeing into Woody's eyes. He's viewing death. Death is on his doorstep.
Staring in the face, yeah.
Because a lot of, like, other studios or like writers, right, would maybe not do that. They'd be like, now we'll get him long before they get into the pit. So, yeah, it is pretty crazy.
He was damned to
And then they two-piece you with the Andy goodbye after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
That's crazy.
They damned him to a fate worse than death, though, I would say, at number 5, which is male pattern baldness.
Yeah.
Bald as fuck.
Yeah.
Although they do fix that. They fix that on him in Toy Story 2, which I forgot about until they
showed him. Yeah, the old guy. One of the most pleasing scenes. It's visually very pleasing.
Yeah.
He just shines his little boot. Number 3. Lower on my list than I kind of thought it would be. One of these movies did not make the top 10, which is shocking, by the way. But I guess I'm partly a fall for it. Number 3, I have at 10, and I didn't realize I had it at 10, but I looked at my list and I'm like, yeah, that's kind of where it belongs. And that is Coco. 10 for me, 3 for Kenjack, 5 for Gooch. Kenjack and I saw the movie together.
Yeah.
What a backbreaker movie this is. Holy shit. But I'd put this up there with Up in terms of best looking Pixar movies. This looks fucking amazing. And the music in this movie is just dynamite.
Yeah. Beautiful story. Great music. vibrant. Great job too, also establishing a world where, like, not all of us like know any about any of this stuff, like Day of the Dead or any of that stuff. So like, I think it really does a good job like teaching you and then immediately bring you into the world, and then like you're immediately like, I want more of this, I want more of this, I want more of this. So like, I think such a great show and great great movie, and also a really good voice cast as well. Gael Garcia, right, is I think I forget the main bad guy's name, his grandfather, whatever. But yeah, really, really enjoyed it. And what's the news on the second one, actually? Because they are doing a Coco 2, right?
That's what they've said, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's actually a good question.
I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah. But yeah, Real love Coco.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, not exactly sure what they're going to go with on that one.
Yeah.
Is it the only Pixar movie that really incorporates music like directly into the text versus like just having the music play? That's a Disney animation thing that they kind of pulled over.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And the music was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that's why I rank it so high, is because I just grew up on Disney animation. I love when characters break out into song, and the music is just so good. I still listen to, I love the Miguel version of Remember Me. It's so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Number two is The Incredibles. Two for Gooch, two for Ken Jack, six for me.
Hell yeah.
I know. I mean, Ken Jack's number one incredible guys in the world.
That was like one of the only DVDs I owned growing up was The Incredibles, and I burned a hole in that thing. I love The Incredibles. Such a cool sort of take, I think, on the superhero world. Really a great original world. Great music. Giacchino's score, right? So, so good. Like, perfectly sets you in that, like, 50s retro-futurism mm-hmm. world or whatever. Voice cast, like, with all these home run, absolute out of the park. I think Syndrome is a great villain. And also, just, like, the fight scenes are cool. The jokes, I think, work for both as a kid. And then when you're an adult, you get a lot more of them, and you think it's even funnier. And Miss Incredible, big fat ass, Pog. Love her as well. So, I got to throw out flowers for all those points above. So, Incredible is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great superhero movie. Like, it's one of the, like, five best. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Pun. Laugh. Intended. Clap, please. Clap, please. Yep.
All intended.
Two is really enjoyable, too. But one just hits different.
Yeah.
One of the best superheroes movies ever made. Right up there with The Dark Knight. Just fantastic. Just an excellent movie. Looks great. Mm-hmm. Holds up. Great vibe. That retro futuristic vibe shit is just always fun. Number one is Toy Story.
Yeah.
100 out of 100 is for me as well, along with Toy Story 3. One of the greatest movies ever made. Perfect.
Is that one for all three of us? Zero notes. I assume that's number one for all three of us.
Yeah, we all had it at number one.
Yeah.
Perfect movie. Like, just a perfect movie. Perfectly paced. No issues. Great villain. Great ending. Holds up for when it was made. It's still amazing. It was made in 1995 mm-hmm. or earlier, I guess, technically, when they started making it before it came out. So, yeah, our list is Toy Story number one, The Incredibles 2, Coco 3, Toy Story 3, Monsters, Inc., Inside Out, Finding Nemo, Up, WALL-E, Toy Story 2. After that, Ratatouille number 11. Shocked this didn't make the list.
Yeah, people are not going to be happy about.
People love Ratatouille. I think it's just good. Like,
four for Gooch, eight for me. Ken Jeck has it at 13.
Yeah, I was never that super high on it. I like it. I've never been like super super high on it.
They just released the Kubrick thing.
Oh, geez, really? What's it look like?
It's a box. It's $479.
Hell yeah.
Playing half a band for fucking
Eyes Wide Shut, DVDs. Full Metal, The Shining, Barry Lyndon, Clockwork, Space Odyssey, Strange Love, Lolita, Spartacus, Path of Glory, The Killing, Killer's Kiss. Let's fucking go. That's a big fucking box, but I think it's a normal looking box. Luckily,
playing half a anyway. $1,000. Jesus,
my God. After that, Soul coming in at 12. Ken, Jack, and I both had it at 12. Soul is great. Soul, big time hurt by COVID. Big time For hurt sure. by COVID.
For sure.
Should have done better. Should have been, yeah, big time hurt by COVID.
I think I'm more impressed by it than I am, like.
Enjoy it?
Yeah.
I'm with you on that, I think. Like, I like it. I like it. But I am now more technically impressed, for sure.
Yeah, and even the score is great. Like, the Reznor-Ross score is fantastic. But it just didn't connect with me fully.
Yeah.
And that's concerning, because I think it was targeted at me. I think it was targeted at adults.
It was. It's easily the most adult thing that they've done, I think, by far, honestly. like, I mean, not by far, but like, it's definitely adult. After that, A Bug's Life, which I will defend this movie. Kendrick, you can have on your, I'll defend this movie up and down the block.
I'm an ants guy.
Oh,
I love dance. Disgusting. I love dance. Kevin Spacey, locust guy, like the fucking.
You're just in the bag for that director.
That's just gross. But I will say that is consistent. You've been consistent about that.
Yeah. Always been an ants guy.
Ah, man. Fucking.
Killian Murphy bug.
Ants. You love Woody Allen ant. Oh, you
Woody
love
Allen
Woody
was,
Allen
he
ant.
He was fantastic. Killian Murphy is what he looks like, but he unfortunately is voiced by.
After that, Defend Away, Gooch. Cars, number 8. Came in at F14.
What's there to defend?
Wait, which
life
Cars?
Life is a Highway. Come on.
Cars 1. The logic of this movie just break. It just, for me, none of it, which doesn't work.
So? Who cares? The Cars, they go fast.
It's just like, but see, here's my issue. And this is where some, like a big Cars head, a big McQueen, a big Lightning McQueen head would probably say, but Jeff, it's fucking talking Cars, brother. And to that, I would say they make other ridiculous things work logically. Right?
For the most part, yeah.
But there's like logic breakdowns with Cars that you're like, this is like, feels like they had an idea and they kind of half-assed it just to get the Cars to talk and shit. That's always been my issue.
Yeah, but they have to talk. That way Paul Newman can talk. Come on. Mm. Paul Newman banger. Doc Hudson.
And I am. I'm number one Paul Newman fan. I do love Paul Newman. But no.
And Larry the Cable Guy. Who can forget?
You like Cars. I can't. Forget Larry the Cable Guy voice is fucking Mater, then, I mean, are you even a movie fan?
It's slop, but like, it's like top line slop.
It's so tough for me because like the other Pixar stuff is so good. And it's not like a slight, at least in my head, against Cars. Like it's not for me. And I think the other stuff is just so much better. So
I think I might just like the fact that like we don't have like animated car movies, like racing movies. And I thought that was just awesome.
How many animated car movies do we need?
Not many, but I'm glad that this is the one franchise that we do have. I think the racing like actually is pretty thrilling.
Hmm. What was the one? Do you remember they made that one movie with the kid from X-Men First Class? Was that Monster Truck?
Oh,
or was
yeah.
Like a monster that lived in his truck.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but didn't that like end up being like kind of a hit?
Yeah, like people did like it, I think, for the most part. But I remember just being like, what is this? But yeah, Monster Truck, I think it was called.
Give me Rascal Flatts over Randy Newman's fake ass any day.
I am the Rascal Flatts defender. I'm with you on that.
By the way, do we accept Taylor Swift's post-credit song, the end-credit song, as an Oscar play? And is it good enough to, like, the campaign is on already. Very much so. Very early campaign. I don't know if that's the right move, but do you think it's good enough to win?
I left while I was playing. It wasn't compelling enough to make me stay and listen to it.
No, it wasn't.
I was like, I'll just listen to it on Spotify or whatever. But
I was expecting it to play during the movie, though.
It should have. Like, just do a montage. Let it play.
Yeah.
Dan Warren is fucking.
I mean, she's. Right now. I would assume it's the first of many attempts she's going to make to try and get an Oscar, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Definitely attainable, too, for her, I think.
It is, but. When the Academy smells that you really want it, that's usually when they don't give it to you.
It's true.
But unlike Diane Warren, she's putting in movies people actually watch, which I do think is a factor here.
Yes. I mean, I obviously there's a huge caveat to that.
Yeah, like Diane
Warren's to be involved.
Yeah, Warren's like making a soundtrack for like, you know, The Mother's Daughter, which is a movie that played in 10 theaters in like Guatemala. And like it just gets nominated every year.
Well, last year it was literally the Diane Warren movie, wasn't it?
The Diane Warren movie, yeah. Where it's like, the song was called like, I'm Diane. Like, so, she still didn't fucking win. It's so funny. It's so good.
After that, Toy Story 4, Turning Red, Kenjik, you had that 11. Okay, Brave, Gooch, you had that. Yeah. Finding Dory, Kenjik, you had that. Incredibles 2, Gooch, you had that. Turning Red is more popular than I realized it was.
I like Turning Red. I think that was a fun story.
Yeah, it's a pretty one. I remember seeing it in the parks, right? Once. Like, kids love Turning Red because they love the band, the K-pop band.
The K-pop band, yeah. And do you remember that one guy that gave it a bad rating because they didn't refer to 9/11? Like, they didn't mention 9/11 during the movie? They're like, this movie, I forget who it was. It might have been like.
Yeah, I do remember that.
I forget who it was, but he's like, this movie's set in 2002 and they don't reference 9/11 at all. It's like, yeah, no shit. It's like, it's a Canadian movie. It's a movie set in Canada in 2002. You think they're going to, in a kid's movie, they're going out of the way to talk about 9/11? It's crazy.
They did in Cars.
They do in Cars. Hmm.
I think so. I think there's like TSA
which implies that 9/11 happened.
Which does confirm that 9/11 did happen.
In the Cars universe.
One last question before we wrap things up. If you had to buy stock right now and put all your eggs in one basket for an animation studio, Pixar, Disney, Animation, Studio G, Sony, and Illumination, I guess.
Studio G is going to probably die out with Miyazaki. So, like, after no one has any faith in Goro. So, like, who's you put your faith in then?
I mean, Sony, Disney, the money? Sony is going, has gone bananas the last 10 years.
Yeah. It's a good point.
Especially now with K-pop.
Who did K-pop? Demon Hunters.
It was Sony?
Sony, yeah. Via Netflix? Okay.
Yep.
So maybe them, I don't know. Like actually, which studio made the insert in Scary Movies 7? Which studio did that fucking bit?
Gooch is still cackling over Scary Movie 7.
Still laughing. Waking still up laughing. In a cold sweat laughing at Scary Movie 7.
Oh my God. So many funny jokes in that movie.
So many fun jokes about smoking weed. How funny is that, that a grown man is smoking weed? Isn't that hilarious?
It is. It is.
God, it was so stupid. Such a bad movie.
Back.
Oh, wow. That's so bad.
Oh, so bad. It was so stupid, dude. Oh, my God.
Come on. Kai Cenat getting his head cut off.
Great. The second he showed up, like, I mentally checked out of the movie so hard. I was just like, we're just doing point and look at thing. Like, it's come on. Let's do something. Yeah. Make a joke here.
Well, that's it. We'll talk Supergirl, some other stuff next week as well. That's our Pixar rankings, though. Shout out to Pixar. But that's it for Gooch, Kenjik. I'm Jeff DeLo. We'll talk to you next time. What happens when you lock 18 coworkers in an office for 1 week to compete for $250,000 of cash? This is Surviving Barstool Season 5, presented by Rumble Premium, where each episode releases 3 hours early. So get it ad-free before anybody else, only when you join Rumble Premium. New episodes of Surviving Barstool will be released every Sunday and Wednesday, leading up to the Labor Day finale on September 7th. You can watch Surviving Barstool at 5 p.m. on Rumble Premium and everywhere else at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Stella Blue Coffee's new can lattes are here. Crafted with 100% Colombian coffee, each can is a good source of protein and comes in two smooth flavors, espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. And whether you're braving your morning commute or chasing your pup, Stella Blue cans are for those always on the go and for those who care. Stella Blue is more than just great coffee. It's about giving back. I named the brand after my rescue dog, Stella, who inspired our mission to help more dogs find their forever homes. Every purchase supports animal rescue organizations, so when you drink Stella Blue, you're not just fueling your day, you're saving a dog's life. Try the new cans today, taste the difference, and make a difference. All new Stella Blue coffee can lattes now available at stellabluecoffee.com or subscribe on Amazon for 10% off.
Stella
Stella Blue Coffee ready-to-drink can lattes are officially available nationwide at Target. That's right. Whether you're making a Target run for toothpaste, paper towels, or somehow spending $200 on things you didn't know you needed, stop by the coffee section and see why everyone is turning to Stella Blue. The cans are made with 100% Colombian coffee, real dairy, real sugar, and contain 190 milligrams of caffeine. They've got dessert-level flavor with coffee-level function. You can choose from espresso, sweet cream, or espresso cafe mocha. And once you try them, you'll understand why they're the best canned lattes out there. Here's the best part. 100% of proceeds will go toward our We Brew to Rescue mission, in which we're funding the adoption of 1,000 pets across the country. Grab a Stella Blue at Target, taste the difference, and make a difference. Stella Blue Coffee.